apologize. We're trying to round up the kettle, and once we've got that, we'll start. Relax, there's tea and coffee outside. Make this your home, seeing as it's your tax money that pays for this. Please eat as much as you like.
Very kind.
I don't know if you've filled in my PNG list.
I
think the other one was the different one. Was it?
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, don't worry.
Good morning once again. We welcome those members that have just arrived just before supper. Welcome. Mrs. Zigalala and Mr. Skosana, I'll teach you later how to read a watch. 9 o'clock is when the big hand is on the 12 and the little hand is on the 9. That's 9 o'clock. I wanted to blame the late starting on the opposition. Unfortunately, Ms. Ndude made it early, so I can't blame the opposition either. That's why I can't blame you, Ms. Ndude. I can't blame the opposition. One or two others are still on their way. As you know, members belong to various committees, so during these hearings, some of them will be in and out. The only apology I got was from look after the rhinos. Was from Mr. Matebe, who had problems with his plane, so he'll be here when his plane is here. And Dr. Kalyan is in London, and as I said, most of the others will be in and out. Any case, I'll be here all the time, so even if I'm only here, we'll continue. Make sure we get through these hearings. Now, as you know, we're not a committee that likes to be disrupted by the media, so we always make sure they're at the back somewhere. But we'll make an exception on this occasion. There's a documentary being made for COP17 by Parliament. And so my bosses have said that I must be nice to the people making the video. So they will be allowed to move around today during the hearing. So please give your nice side, if it's the left side, please give, now look at this, you see, yeah, here's a good example. If the left side is the best side, you give the left side to the camera, okay? Just for those that don't know how to do this, I'm just demonstrating. Put your best side forward, Ms. Ndude, just make sure they get a good shot of you. So they'll be the exception to make their documentary. Now, we now have a white paper on climate change. That means that our government now has a policy on climate change. Now the interesting thing is we've called it a white paper, but I was sitting thinking about it last night. It's not really a white paper in the true sense of a word. I mean, a white paper is really a policy document that sets out the policy in some area, transport, housing and so on. What it really is a framework within which government tries to coordinate and manage all the issues of climate change. As we know, climate change, when it really starts biting, is going to affect all aspects of life. Droughts, abundance of water, diseases, food shortages, food plentiful. And so it really is an issue that encompasses all aspects of life. It will impact on all aspects of life, and therefore the response to climate change has to include all aspects of life. However, there is no department that deals with all aspects of life. Cabinet deals with it, not a department. And so really what this department has done in the white paper, and that's why you'll find very little policy in it in terms of transport or housing or whatever. What it really does, it creates a framework in which this whole response will take place by government. And of course that framework will be dealt with and monitored by the Department of Environment and its equivalent in Parliament, which is this committee. So it's very important that we in our responses to the document, that we see the document in that sense. That it's really a framework of how government will coordinate and manage all the policies in government that have an impact on climate change, which is just about all policies. So it's very important to do, and that's why you're not going to find details on this issue and that issue and the other issue. Those we will have to as we start developing the white paper, we're going to have to find tools and mechanisms how this committee and other committees can make sure that this strategic framework of pulling together these policies of government, that they're actually being implemented by the departments, that there's not an imbalance, so we're not acting in housing, but we're acting in transport, for example. So it's going to be a very delicate issue. It's not something that we're used to as politicians, as government. And so it's something unique, and we're going to have to develop the tools, the skills, the mechanisms. And I hope that in doing this, we'll be able to get the involvement of all our stakeholders, civil society in the form of business, in the form of labor, in the form of the NGOs, communities, etc., etc. No one, I want to emphasize, has all the answers to this issue. This issue is going to have to be a partnership. We're going to have to find ways of finding the right balances and finding the right ways to respond to this issue. And so in that sense, some of the things that worry me is that, we get a tornado, which is devastating, and so on, and, we suddenly say, well, this is an effect of climate change. Well, it may be, it may not be. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you change the DNA of our society? So the way our DNA now is that we all agree, or most of us agree, some of us are denialists, so we won't agree, but we all agree that the way that our economy developed, the way our country developed, the way we historically became what we are, has certain problems in it, built into it. And that is the fact that, of course, we have a very high fossil fuel-driven economy, and that's part of the DNA of the economy. So it's the DNA that we have to change, which is not easy. And in changing that DNA, that will be our response to fitting in first into the world, by trying to, firstly, I think, set an example. But secondly, of course, to make sure that we do not do things that we would not want to see, and that is to be a great emitter. And so really, the issue is, how do you change the DNA from what it is now, whatever you want to categorize it as, to a more low-carbon economy? Whether that's going to affect climate change or not, if it does, if it's a good response, that is good. But because none of us can actually link specific events to it, the issue is really, is this the right thing to do? And I think that government, through the white paper, and I think all the opposition parties, everyone is in agreement, most of civil society, that this is the response we want as a government. It's a painful one. That is to move to this low carbon economy so that we become part of the mainstream of the development and technological changes in the world. And so I think it's very important that we look at this white paper in that sense. Of course, it is already a policy. So I know some people are saying, so why are you having public hearings? Well, we have public hearings for a lot of reasons. Firstly, although you've had an input into this process all along from 2005, and in the Green Paper we had a very strong input by this committee, the first thing we want to do as a committee is to see that all the issues that we raised out of the Green Paper have been captured in the White Paper. That's the first thing this committee would want to do. Secondly, it would want to give civil society another opportunity to tell us where they see shortcomings or problems in the White Paper. Because, quite contrary to what some people say, a policy or a white paper is just that. It's a policy or white paper at a given time in history. But there's no reason why there can't be changes made next year, the year after, the year after, as we start becoming more sophisticated in our responses to climate change. It may very well be that some of the things that we're agreeing to now are not necessarily the right ones, or they have to be tweaked, etc., etc. So it's very important that we see the white paper and the development of policies and the coordination and management of the response of government and society to climate change as an ongoing process. It's not something that's going to stop with this white paper. The white paper is only the beginning of the process. It is a culmination of consultations into a document, and go forward. So those that would want to argue that we've gone overboard and there's no problem with climate change, they will have continuous chances to tell us that for the rest of their lives. Those of us that feel that maybe there's too little response, they will be able to tell that for the rest of our lives. And hopefully we'll get the right balances in between by consulting, by engaging, and so on. And so that is really, although this is a policy of government, we see this as the beginning of a process of us getting the right balanced policies for our response to climate change. And if there are weaknesses in this white paper, then we as a committee would, after we've heard everyone, would inform government of what we think about it and how we think this should be dealt with. On the other hand, of course, we also know that there's COP17 taking place on our shores at the end of the year. And it's very important. I find it a big imbalance at the moment. People talk about COP and that in this country, our people, but very few people have actually dealt with the white paper. I mean, I haven't seen people write articles on the white paper and so on and so on. We're leading up to COP. This is now this government's response to climate change. Climate change conference starts in less than 2 or 3 weeks, and we're not as a nation actually saying what it is that our response, our government has agreed to deal with this. Whether we fully agree with it or not is not the issue. The issue is there is this paper, and why aren't we actually highlighting it? Now, I hope that these public hearings will help us also give some prominence to the white paper, the policies of government, and how we're responding to our responsibilities in dealing with climate change and our response to it. So there's a whole lot of purposes this is taking place, and I think it couldn't have happened probably at a better time than it is in these weeks. Now, we have sent the program to people. You'll see that basically we will be meeting for 3 weeks, the next 3 weeks, today and tomorrow morning, in the mornings, because the House sits in the afternoon, we will take mainly inputs from NGOs, community organizations, and so on. Next week, Tuesday, the business community is coming to give inputs. And then the Wednesday after that, again, the rest of community organizations, NGOs, and so on, and various other people that have expertise in this area. So it's this month, this Tuesday and Wednesday, next Tuesday and Wednesday morning, and then the third week it'll be Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday to try and fill in all the extra submissions. A lot of those submissions have been made by individuals, so I'm not sure if they'll come on the Friday. We'll let you know closer to the time. But it's 2 days now, 2 days next week, and 3 days in the third week. And then hopefully we'll have finished our hearings on this. That's in any case the second last week of Parliament before we rise. At some stage we may just have a bit of a discussion also in the committee how to deal with it. So that is really the program. I hope all of you have. We have had one or two changes. Today one group has withdrawn, and tomorrow another one is withdrawn. We put someone else in. So you'll get updated programs as well. Now, on the modus operandi of the committee, you know that you can take it that we have read your submissions. We usually give you 10 to 15 minutes to make an oral presentation. It's very important that you stick to the main points you want to make. I mean, you can go into, I mean, it's your own, but really to get a debate going and to try and get your points through to Parliament, it's important to concentrate on the main points. At least in your 10, 15 minutes, we know exactly what all your main points are. And then for the rest of the 45 minutes, there will be questions and answers. I don't allow for much flexibility on the time, else we're just going to get problems with our program. So let's try and stick strictly to the time limits. I also can tell you now already that once you've made your submission and some issues have been raised maybe which you would like to elaborate on or which you didn't deal with in your submission, you'd like to do it. We do accept further written submissions. There won't be another oral submission once you've sent it, but you can really, any of the people that make submissions can at any stage supplement or make a further submission. You're more than welcome to do so. We do circulate that to members, and it will also be a public document once you've done so. I think those are all the issues I wanted to raise up front. Any issues from the committee that we have to raise? All right. Just remember, every morning we're starting at 9. I know it's tough for some members, but we'll just, it's the only way we're going to fit the program in, okay? I'm sorry about that. All right, let's start. Our first submission is submission number 28, Greenpeace. Ms. Adams is representing the organization. You will find that a submission, as I said, is 28, but I think there's also the, have you circulated? You've circulated the input for today. It says, Greenpeace GPAFR comments on climate change. It looks like this. Ms. Adam, it's over to you. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. The GPAFR is Greenpeace Africa. In general terms, Greenpeace Africa welcomes the finalization of the National Climate Change Response White Paper, but, I mean, it comes to my next point, but we're just concerned that at the final stages, and it's taken us, as you've mentioned, since 2005, 2006 to get to this point, that there seems to be an element of hate for comments. What we found is that this final, well, the white paper, as we see it, is substantially different to what was in the green paper. I mean, even in terms of the amount of pages, the way things are laid out, etc. A lot of changes have been made. A lot of these changes are good, but we were given only 8 days to actually comment. And we found that a bit difficult, given that these documents were substantially different. So the good things that we find in the white paper, and as you can see, I've put some little pictures because I think we're reaching the end of our road and there needs to be some kind of recognition of that. And we're very happy that it does not explicitly refer to nuclear energy anymore, so that's a very big plus for us. Also, in the previous one, there were no numbers and targets, and we're glad to see that there's inclusion of mitigation targets. But maybe, Chair, you've answered some of this in terms of if the white paper has already been approved by Cabinet, how will any of the comments that we're going to be seeing in the next few weeks be incorporated into the final document, and if they will be incorporated into the final document? And if it's going to be a framework, then I think we need to change that word immediately and call it a framework. Some of the concerns we had, once again, the baseline used for the business as usual is still not very clear. We're not sure where they're getting the baseline from. We also find that a number of issues that are mentioned for the first time in the white paper, after not appearing in the green paper, and thus the 8 days given to us to comment was really very limited. We're not saying that we don't like these ideas. We think that they're very important, but we would have liked to have done a little bit more work on it. So, example, the concept of a carbon budget, an emissions trajectory range, and near-term priority flagship programs that have been identified. How were they identified? Because I know that the green paper had a whole list of other programs as well. We think that it's time for the South African government to actually start taking the lead. So in terms of the long-term goal, the white paper, I'm calling it a white paper, but I'm not sure if it's a framework, but for now I'll just continue using white paper. Still makes reference to below 2 degrees Celsius, and we find that really, really strange given that COP17 is going to be in Durban, and South Africa has been very proud about taking the African position on many issues, and the Africa group's position is a temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So to keep in line with the Africa group position, we think that needs to be changed. the National Climate Change Response Objective, which talks about a fair contribution, the language in Bullet 2 of Section 2, should be changed to taking a leadership role in the global effort to achieve the stabilization of greenhouse gases. And I think South Africa can do that in Africa as a leader. In terms of adaptation, we're really, really glad that the strange idea to reserve clean water to dilute pollution has been removed. I think that was a really, really bad idea, given that we have a water-scarce country. In terms of mitigation, we think that more research is required on the carbon budget to establish the carbon budget under 1.5 degrees Celsius emissions pathway, and this should become a near-term priority for the Department of Environmental Affairs in the white paper. We're also wondering, and it wasn't clear, as I mentioned previously, how was the national greenhouse gas emissions trajectory range defined? Are the targets in the white paper... Okay, then... Okay, because that would be very useful for us to look at, and then if we can send any, as you said, written comments on that. Are the targets in the white paper consistent with scientific realities or the political realities of a fair share? And we know that that's going to be happening in Durban, and we hope that South Africa doesn't do the same on our national soil. Are the mitigation targets in line with either national or international research on what is required to avoid catastrophic climate change and to keep within the 1.5 degrees Celsius? I think it's important for us to keep to the 1.5, which is an Africa group position. In terms of the peak, plateau, and decline, it's quite clear that we have, internationally and nationally, we have wasted time in kind of, not wasted time, but it's taken a long time to get to a final document. We don't have one internationally, and the longer we wait, the harder it is going to be to deal with the impacts of climate change. A plateau in emissions for 10 to 15 years is absolutely not in line with what is required by science anymore. We can't think that way. 6, 7, 8 years ago, we had that opportunity, but time is running out, and we need to move with what science is demanding, and we're saying that we need to have a peak and a decline, because we're reaching the tipping point far more quickly than we expected, and we need to react much more quicker as well. So the white paper should refer to a peak and decline. In terms of finance and technology, the white paper states that South Africa's emissions reductions are dependent on international finance and technology. And we understand where this is coming from, but this conditionality must be removed in terms of national action. It is time for South Africa to... We're saying, in terms of South Africa's national position, we need to go first in terms of not according to waiting for finance and technology, because South Africa, compared to other African countries, can afford to do so. So similarly, in terms of the bringing down the temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we can do that as South Africa. We're one of the biggest emitters, and so we need to take the lead in terms of that Africa position. And in terms of waiting for finance and technology, we don't have to wait. We can go ahead to reduce our emissions much quicker and take the lead on that. Some really, really bad ideas in the white paper. Once again, we see carbon capture and storage in place in the white paper, and we find this as a false solution to climate change. The technology is not viable at present, and renewable energy solutions are a much better option. In fact, CCS is still very theoretical. It's expensive. It's another expense that South Africa could rather take that money and use it for something more productive. So we really think we should not be endorsing CCS. Some really quick fixes that we think are good and are good that it's in the white paper and we can actually start developing those right now is the partnering with stakeholders. We just think that in the present white paper it puts the whole idea of civil society as very superficial in a we'll use civil society to critically evaluate, comment on and respond to. But I think there are lots of organizations, community-based organizations, that are actually doing research on the ground. And they need to be used for that experience, what they're going through, and in terms of research and information, so not just in terms of consultative. Coordination mechanisms. The NCCC was mentioned as a good way of having coordination and for government to provide reports. It hasn't been working really well this year. We've had some NCCC meetings, some were not very good and useful, but I do think that there's a potential to actually expand that function. It's a good structure that we need to look at how we use it better. In terms of market-based instruments, the carbon tax issue, we know that somehow that debate's on hold, but it's in the white paper, so we need to look at how and what exactly we mean when we say the carbon tax. Greenpeace strongly urges the government to ring-fence the money coming from carbon taxes to go towards renewable energy development so that the tax doesn't get lost in a big pot somewhere. Finally, South Africa has a responsibility to act with urgency given that we are the 12th highest emitter in the world. Of course, a final white paper is definitely needed in South Africa, but it must not be fast-tracked and motivated by the COP17. This document is going to define how we function for the foreseeable future to combat climate change and cannot just be a media exercise to show the world that we have something on climate change. To have come so far and then fail at the final hurdle would be tragic. Greenpeace Africa urges the government to ensure that once this process is completed, that the mechanisms to implement the policy will be put into place as soon as possible. So we welcome the end of this process, but we really, really don't want to be rushed, and we think that giving us 8 days to comment, we did feel that we didn't have the full, as you say, you had a document online, we would have wanted to have that access to that document. Thank you.
Now, we accept that 8 days is short. The problem is that this is a policy now of government. It's not one that's going to change now immediately. As I said, we will engage with it and give our views on what it is. And we have accepted as a committee that 8 days is short, it's a bit more than 8 days, but the fact of the matter is it was a short period. We've acknowledged that. The issue is, if we wanted civil society to make some comment before COP, this is the only time. When do we do it elsewhere? So we accept that in the usual, but as I said, this is an engagement that will continue every year after this. And please, people must feel free to give their comments to the committee. We will at least once a year or more have a session around climate change and what we're doing and how government is performing and so on. So this is going to be an ongoing process. So it's not going to be the end of the road. I think, as I've said, no one's got all the answers, and definitely some of the things that are on this paper in time will change. We'll find that they're either outdated or they're not enough or they're too much, and we'll have to change it as we go along. So we accept that we would have liked more time. Unfortunately, Cabinet adopted the white paper only when it did, and that has just left us with a little time. So we accept that. All right, members, there's a... Anyone want to engage with Greenpeace on ask questions, make comments? Mr. Morgan, kick off for us.
Thank you very much. I just want to focus on one particular issue which you have raised, and that is carbon capture and storage. I would like you to expand on this particular section on why Greenpeace Africa is so vehemently opposed to it. I understand and I agree that in terms of development, it's very, very early days. On a personal level, though, you know, I'm curious about what its potential is, and I'm wondering why Greenpeace Africa isn't interested either in the possible innovations that go with carbon capture and storage, which I would imagine could, and I'm not saying would, could have a role in the transitioning to a low carbon economy. My feeling is that with a complex issue like the transition to a low carbon economy, excluding things only limits the possibilities. And you know, I guess you will probably say, well, you know, let's even be more ambitious. But there are going to be a huge amount of challenges ahead. We are, you know, for several reasons, locked in, which I'm personally very sad about, a certain amount of coal generation for a considerable period of time now. And I know that Greenpeace Africa never agreed with the building of new coal power stations. I wouldn't have liked to see them either. Nevertheless, they are going to be with us for some time. That's just the reality, quite frankly. So why not CCS at all? And if you are concerned about the South African situation, I mean, why not let the rest of the world develop the technology at their cost and see whether, in fact, it does have applicability at all in South Africa. So thank you very much. Cheers.
Mr. Skosan.
Chakasan, thank you very much. Let me accept and congratulate the input that we got from your company. You have got a statement under PEC, Plateau and Decline, which says in Bulletin 2, a plateau in emissions for 10 to 15 years is absolutely not in line with what is required by science. I just want you a bit just to elaborate on this. What does need by science? In terms of years, as you say, 10 to 15 years is not in line with the requirement of science. And also the thinking of your company in terms of years. What do you think that years that can assist us can be in reducing these emissions? Thank you.
Dr. Huang?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I also like to thank you for this Greenpeace for contribute. Regarding for the you highlighted for now, is this time for the South Africa will be leading for this stage. But the problem is without for the finance and technology. I think this one is a process by the all that is a. This is a finance process. If any process without the money coming, I don't think so it can fast. Even the South Africa want to lead in for the COP17. I think you also must be know is that we have the Clean Technology Fund from UN. So ESCOM also has some funding from this fund. So I think it's already the process for the funding. So South Africa, if one leading for this stage for the climate change, I think we still need for many debate for the financial issue. So I appreciate for your comment. It's quite good. Thank you.
Ms. Zigalala.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the presentation. Anyway, as I was listening, I heard that civil society, community-based organizations will be involved. But I'm worrying a bit. Because it seems some of the people do not understand what is meant by climate change. And yet it affects everybody, more especially in our country, South Africa. And I don't know what best can be done, that it goes down to the grassroots for them to understand clearly at their level what is meant by climate change. For instance, because they just have to know that if you prepare a brazier using coal, that smoke has something to do with climate change. Air pollution, the cars that we drive, the exhaust pipes, the cars that are like the diesel, for you know, that can come to their level in a way. But I'm made to understand that they will be represented in the COP17 down in Durban, whereby those people, I hope, they will have to go back to the communities, to the ordinary laymen, just for him or her to understand clearly. There is this tree planting. How can that be done? By whom? Or maybe you can just organize to go and plant trees at a certain school, certain community place. I just want to be clear, you know. I'm just thinking aloud. In other words, Chairperson, I'm trying to say, at a certain stage, it must be simplified. I'm sorry to say this. We had a workshop which was organized by the Multi-Party Women's Caucus, whereby we invited quite a number of stakeholders, presenters. They came, I'm telling you, the way they were putting it across, it was good for everybody. The simplicity, and yet it was perfect. I even said, how I wish some of them can be given a chance to present down there in Devon. Because I believed everybody would just know what is meant by climate change, the dangers caused by, you know, some of these emissions of, you name them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ma. Ms. Ndude.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, Ms. Adams. I must say that in some of your comments here, I really, from where I'm sitting, from the opposition bench, I really agree with you, you know, and a number of the comments that you've made here. But there's this one on the real bad ideas. I think that the language used there for me is sort of, I must say, it's harsh. It's harsh. Maybe you can, you know, sort of, you know, try to assist. You know, I always believe that it's always good to criticize, but it is also important that we must also come with solutions. I'm talking on the real bad ideas. Real bad ideas, you can underline that. Where you're saying that carbon capture and storage is a false solution to climate change. And then you go on to say that the technology is not viable at present and whatnot. The issue there for me, my comment will be to you and Greenpeace. What would you think? Because remember that this will become policy for the country and it affects you and me. So therefore it is important that we just don't see it as a bad, but what do we think can be the solution so that we can be able to incorporate or input on that in this exercise that we are doing of the white paper. So if you can talk to that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Skosana, another one?
Chair, as they are trying to give responses to these questions, I should think the last bulletin also must be answered. To say, CCS is still theoretically and is untried and untested, and government should not endorse this program. I should think we need a clarity on that. For this government, we are here to endorse programs and policies and implement. If you say you must not, we need a little bit clarity on that. Thank you, Chair.
I do trust that this issue of the trajectory, how it is calculated and whether it complies with science, I do hope people look at that. There is an explanation available somewhere here from the department. But this is one of the issues we fought for very hard under the Green Paper, to change this. And as a committee, we're very happy that in the way we've gone, the way that we've looked at the targets plus the trajectory, all falls within us meeting the scientific parameters that we had to meet. So I would really ask that people look at that and see if they can comment further for us. In line with that, the issue really is, once you've set the targets and the trajectory, then the issue of carbon budgets, which an intergovernmental committee will look at regularly and update or up or down the carbon budgets, then each sector will get a target they have to meet. So the transport sector will have to meet a target. That's the only way we're going to meet the trajectory. And then, of course, there are special economic instruments we're going to use, like the carbon tax. So you have to look at the what we've said for mitigation, plus all the different strands of how to meet it. I will suggest that we took 2 days of inputs from the departments and so on. Those inputs are available if you want to look at them. There is one on carbon tax, for example. Treasury came and explained to us what they're looking at carbon tax. We had an input from the National Planning Commission, but that was a bit premature because they only agreed to their plan last Friday. So we'll have them again. And then the department itself explaining all the different steps to meet. So I realize that there was little time, but I do ask that people look at that explanation and so on and see if there are weaknesses so that we can engage the department further, including the carbon tax, which is something that the other committee is still working on. And then just to say, this issue you've raised about the international finance and technology, I think that at a theoretical level, you're right. I mean, clearly, our policy document cannot be dependent on whether we're going to get money from elsewhere. We have to at least do what we can do. However, the problem by taking it out is you actually deny the past. Because the whole issue of common and differentiated approach is captured in exactly that clause. That, okay, you did all the damage in the past. You're going to have to reduce to some extent, but how are you going to help us do it, us being the rest of the developed world? So on the one hand, it's a very difficult thing for South Africa. On the one hand, clearly we want to make sure that we respond to this. But on the other hand, if we take that condition out, we actually deny hugely the kind of sins of the past of those countries. So I think we must look at this in a more balanced way. Hopefully every year, by us engaging our own country, we'll be able to see how we're acting and we're not waiting for money and technology. On the other hand, if we seriously want to move quickly with this and try and meet the trajectory, you have to have the condition of technology and finance from the international community. I mean, if we don't have that, we will then start falling behind. So I think I hear what you're saying, but I think equally we need to find another response to it. By taking it out completely is going to create other problems for us. So those are just two issues you can also comment on. Those are all the questions. We're going to take some comment. Thank you, Ms. Adam.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of, I'm going to go as the questions were provided to me. Mr. Morgan asked about why we oppose to carbon capture and storage. There's a few reasons. I mean, one of which is that it's still in its... it's still in a research phase. It has not been proven to work, and by the time we think that carbon capture and storage might be viable, it could be 20 to 25 years from now. Given that, in terms of what we need to do in the meantime, we need to reduce pretty quickly. So that kind of expands that time. Also, it's not just about South Africa, and then Mr. Skosana said as well, why don't we accept international research? I think you said it as well, is that it's not just about accepting international research, it's about South Africa planning to put a lot of money and resources into CCS. And we're saying that given that internationally it's still a far way off to actually have any, you know, real potential. We can't even comment on that potential because it's in a research phase. And when it does come up, it would be 20 to 30 years. But can we wait? Can we wait to allow our greenhouse gas emissions to go that far, spend all that money on a technology that might not work? And that's what we're saying. If we have that money, let's put it into renewable energy. And that can work. That's been proven. It's not in research phase. A colleague of mine said it's not science fiction. So that's why we're saying no at this point to carbon capture and storage, especially for putting it into a white paper on climate change where it's not proven technology yet.
Or dependent on this?
Well, I think it will be very...
But you're saying it's going to take 25 years. Now, that has only got an effect if it's going to hold back something in the paper. If it's not going to hold back something in the paper, it's something that we could or could not have.
Then
makes your argument different.
Well, there are two things. One is that we will then be placing a lot of our mitigation and our baseline in terms of reduction based on, well, we'll have carbon capture and storage as one of the technologies that will be able to account for so much of emissions reduction, which is a false thing. We're basing it on a research. The second thing is we're going to be wasting money on this research that we can start spending on renewable energy. So there's two issues. It's in terms of the reduction and in terms of putting money in other areas that work.
But the carbon budget, the economic measures like the tax and the sector targets, that's not dependent on CCS. That's what I'm asking you. I mean, if part of the program was dependent on CCS, then I can see the huge problem. So what your argument then is left, or can we spend the money better? That's really the
and
argument.
Also the fact that if we're going to want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and we can't just be done with carbon tax and carbon budgets. It has to be done with the much more overhaul of our energy system, which is a long-term process, and that means more investment in renewable energy. And if we are investing in other things like carbon capture and storage, which is not proven to work, that's investment that doesn't then go into renewable energy.
Okay. I hear you.
And then on the issue of what do you mean by science, there's a whole range of everything around climate change in terms of reductions, in terms of what we need to get to, as you know, we need to reach a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius. All of that is based on science that has been done, studies that have been done, and we've used the IPCC documents on that, which we are saying is outdated and is being reviewed. So we're going to get an IPCC review in 2015, but we're saying we can't wait until then. The view right now is that we need to reduce much faster. Also, South Africa has its own long-term mitigation scenarios. A lot of that was based on scientific evidence and plugged into a model, and this is what it was saying we need to do. That was done 8 years ago when we had time to say we can still have a plateau period which will allow business as usual for 10 to 15 years. What we're saying is we've lost that time to reach the targets that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and reduce temperatures, keep temperatures below 1.5 degrees. So bearing in mind that, we're saying having that plateau period will just exacerbate the issue at this point because we've waited so long. So that's based on the long-term mitigation scenarios and the science papers from the review from the IPCC. What can we do to reduce emissions? Stop building coal-fired power stations. Besides that, I think we need, I think we're on the track in terms of we need to take harsh decisions. So I like the idea that the chairperson talks about the carbon budgets in terms of each sector. So transport's a big emitter as well. We need to look at transport. We need to look at industry. We need to look at those industries that use up a lot of energy and electricity but have low job potential, etc., and they can be reduced and reducing our energy demand in total. So those are the kinds of things we can do to reduce our emissions. We can also start investing much more in renewable energy. And there is a research document, if anyone is interested, it's called the Energy Revolution Scenario that Greenpeace has released. It's on our website, which shows how we can move away from the energy that we're using now in terms of coal towards 50% of renewable energy by 2030. So we can do that if we just have a quick, we do it quite quickly. In terms of the finance and technology, the issue is that within the international negotiations, the discussions that they're having in terms of we will do X, Y, and Z if we are giving the finance and technology. Yes, that is a negotiation thing that the group, the Africa group, is standing by. The issue with that and why South Africa cannot wait for that is that that finance and that technology will be mostly given to least developed countries and the most vulnerable countries. South Africa does not sit in that, in those kind of defining sectors. So we can, we regard it quite honestly as an emerging country within the discussions. We align ourselves with basics, which is Brazil, India, China. Those are big countries that they're saying must, the discussions at the international negotiations that all of these countries need to take a step to reduce. So it's not as if we're going to get first tap on those on the finance and technology that's going to be provided by the international negotiations. That is why I'm saying it should not be in our documents because that will hold us back. We need to start taking action now. We can.
But don't you think the fact that we've got a policy now is exactly that?
But
I mean, any of you can now get up, and any of us in Parliament can get up and say to the government, what money are you putting to this? What have you done? Because it's a policy of government. So the fact that there's a policy now is exactly, and the issue on what we will work. And then, of course, there's a thing called international negotiations, which we also dabble in a bit. So I do think we mustn't, we must hold our government to account on the basis of the white paper.
Exactly. And if we try to hold them to account, they will say, well, we did say we're waiting for international finance and technology, which is going to take a long time to get to South Africa.
But that's not how the paper is drafted. The paper is drafted on the basis that all these policies on renewable energy exist. They're there under the IPAP. They've not been watered down by this in any way. So you must keep pushing for 80% renewable energy. So poor Cecil there can almost have a heart attack.
Yeah, I'm sure they would.
Now, all I'm just saying is, I think, you know, the point you've made is a good one, but we, yeah, although we agree with that point, I think, as a committee, we also say that government has committed itself on all these things, and we expect action on it. And in the end of the day, if we don't get that technology and that kind of finance, well, that should not... And that is our attitude. That should not be the ones that are holding back. But equally, we're saying, if we do get the technology and the finance, of course, we can move quicker. And that's really the point. We want to move quicker.
But we need to bear in mind that we might not be the first ones to get that finance.
Oh, of course, of course.
And that
the,
is
the
why...
The fund will be there. And if they, look, let me say, if there'll ever be a fund, because every COP, a new fund is created and the other one is dumped. But if there's ever a fund... At least we can then apply to it.
I think, Chair, you need to say, if there's a fund...
That's an interesting thing. What I wanted to know is, you've not raised it, and I haven't seen it raised in any of the papers. This paper doesn't actually deal with a fund for South Africa, our own fund.
Well, we do mention that in terms of the carbon tax, that should be ring-fenced.
Do you, oh, yes, you, for that one.
Yes.
But you didn't... I'm just surprised, and we asked the department, I can't remember their response, I can't remember why they didn't put a... I mean, we keep on talking about having a South African fund as well for climate change. And clearly the funds we may get from international will go into there, and then the rules will apply. But now that I'm saying, this paper doesn't actually mention it. But sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Okay. I lost my point, but the next one was the issue of climate change being simplified. You're very right, Vikalala. I think that is an issue, and we would have liked to have seen, with South Africa hosting COP17, that more information and awareness was available in terms of people on the ground. For what we know, a lot of organizations have done that, but our resources are limited. We have limited access, so we go to a certain amount of people, and we have been doing a lot of workshops around climate change, what is climate change, the impact of climate change, right across the board. One of my comrades actually said, the government needs to do more, and this was at an NCCC meeting, and government said they don't have money. And she said, yes, but you have money to go when you need votes to every door, and when you need to do the census to every door. And this is an important issue. Shouldn't we be going to every door? So I leave that back in terms of government's responsibility. And then in terms of the Honourable Ms. Ndule has left in terms of the really bad ideas, the phrasing of our words. We are activists. We see things, and as we see things, we will say what we are feeling. We didn't use very bad words. I think a really bad idea is really not harsh. It's a view. And yes, we
NGOs aren't that bad. They don't really just talk and only think later. Come on, you're wrong.
No, we never do. But in terms of alternatives, we have a document called the Energy Revolution Scenarios, which provides alternatives to coal-fired power stations and, of course, nuclear, and how we really don't need Kusile. And so that document can be made available to the Portfolio Committee if you want. I did bring other documents which show the true cost of coal and the true cost of nuclear in South Africa, and I think that's part of the kind of work we do. So we don't only use bad language, we actually do come up with research that can be used. Thank you.
Now there's this one that's been given to us. You can give us others if you've got it. We'll let the people read. All right, thank you very much. That was a good start. Ms. Adam, I appreciate the work. Again, the committee apologizes for the short time, but we thought rather short time than no time, and I think our decision was probably right on that. As I said, people must please see this as part of a process. We will now take this white paper and keep moving with it for the next few years. Please get the documents that you don't have. If there are further comments you want to make, you're more than welcome to do so. And we will definitely circulate it to members. So thank you very much for your time and your effort. We now have Earth Life Africa, submission number 8. And it's Mr. Taylor. Where's Mr. Taylor?
I am here, sir.
Hi.
Hello.
You have your 10 to 15 minutes. Please tell us what you want to tell us.
Sure.
And I'm welcome here.
Thank you for welcoming, and it's a pleasure to be here. I don't have a PowerPoint. I'm not going to endure another PowerPoint upon you. I'm sure you need lots
terrible,
of them.
That's terrible. It's already 5 marks off your input.
Is it 5 marks off? Well, that gives me 95, and we can...
Let's see what you can do with your 95.
That's what I'm going to do, my 95. Well, I am part of the 99%, so we'll see what happens. I will reference pages in our written submission, which I believe you have both read and have in front of you. First of all, the national white paper is actually an improvement over the green paper, and that's quite pleasurable to see. In particular, the exclusion of nuclear power from the document, the addition of numerical values and mitigation targets. Let me talk about that for 1 second before I go on. We've been pushing the Department of Environment since 2009, since President Zuma made his Copenhagen commitment, to actually attach numerical values to those commitments, because without numerical values, those commitments essentially have no epistemological meaning. But now we actually have meaning to those commitments in which we can actually make an analysis, which is why the notice period in this is actually incredibly short, from a technical point of view, because this is the first time we have seen numerical solid figures on what South Africa's emissions pathways will be. So I'll be spending most of my time talking about those figures and how they correlate to the science and whether they are fair. we would have liked to have given a lot more input, but time was very short. We're quite happy to see a carbon budget approach. We think this is quite a revolutionary approach. It's a very good approach, and the government should be commended for doing that. And we like the idea that there's a commitment to keep well below a maximum of 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Unfortunately, all the problems with the white paper tend to grow around with those issues as well. So it's a kind of a... However, I would like to also talk about the short notice period from a different point of view. The white paper specifically says...
Just skip that, okay? Don't waste your time.
Well, no, I think there's an important point in the white paper that actually has to be mentioned. The white paper specifically mandates civil society. One of the things it wants civil society to do is to go to grassroots communities to explain matters to them and to spread it out.
You hear, Mr. Taylor, you're making the submission. We've acknowledged it short time. Just leave it, okay? I mean, what do you want to do? We either have the hearings now or we don't have them before COP. It's just simple. So, you know, we've made the point and that's the position. So there's no use trying to harp on the thing. You're just wasting your time.
I'm
not going to impress anyone with it, really.
All right, well, I'm not really...
Get to some important points. Come.
Okay, first of all, we're starting point for engaging with this with the Section 24 of the Constitution, and in particular the mandate of this country, citizens to have a clean self and hate the environment. And in particular, that means that if there's something wrong in the white paper, we would see that Parliament would have a constitutional mandate to amend, alter, change, etc., if it violates the Constitution. That's our first point. And quite clearly that even in the white paper says it, that a country blighted by the worst effects of climate change is not within the constitutional mandate. It doesn't qualify as a clean, safe, or healthy environment. So we'll start there. So looking at that, and one of the problems of the white paper is that it doesn't take on a carbon budget for the country as a whole. It has domestic carbon budgets in which specific emitters, I think over 0.1 megatons of carbon dioxide, be given a budget. But the country as a whole isn't given a budgeted approach, which is slightly odd. We argue that the white paper should firmly endorse a 1.5 degrees warming for the global temperature and a global peak in temperature about 2011 to 2012. That peak in global temperature, if you look at page 4 of our submission, you'll see a table from the International Panel on Climate Change there, which is specifically endorsed by the white paper. And if you look at the first line of that table, where it is Roman numeral 1, you'll see that the peaking year for CO2 emissions for a 2 degrees pathway is somewhere between 2000 to 2015. This is the science that the white paper endorses. So that means if you're going to keep to well below 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees, you would have to have a global peak effectively now. There's no time not to have a global peak. So if there's a global peak now, according to the science, that then also gives you a carbon budget, which has been calculated and can be calculated for the globe. So we know how much the globe has to emit in total. And that figure is about 750 gigatons of carbon dioxide from about 2010 to 2050. To give you an idea of how little carbon that is, the known oil, gas, and coal reserves of the world that are known, proven, economically viable to mine today. It's not future reserves, it's not ultimate reserves, it's just what we have in the ground today that we can get at under today's prices. There's about 2,800 gigatons of carbon dioxide. So we have to actually leave an entirely a lot amount and global perspective of coal, natural gas in the ground in order to avoid a 2 degrees warming, let alone a 1.5 degree warming. Why I think many of us go on for a 2 degrees is that it's been probably shown that we risk from the paleontological record and the scientific record of things like ice cores and how the climate has reacted in the past from the Permian age to date is that we hold a good chance of hitting significant tipping points at 2 degrees in which the Earth's natural processes will take over and then it doesn't matter what we do. We will heat through natural processes, not actually human-made. So we would strongly suggest the white paper goes to 1.5, not just to keep with the Africa group, the island states, or the Alba group, but also to keep to our constitution. The peak and plateau and decline trajectory, which my comrade here, Ferriol, talked about, is neither fair nor in line with the science. And I would suggest that we refer to page 8 and 10 of my document, or Earth Life's document.
What page?
Sorry, it was 9 and 10, sorry.
9 and 10, okay.
8, 9, and 10. On page 8, you see a series of graphs, and this is graphs that have been analyzed in terms of fair, common, and differentiated responsibilities or different capabilities. And you see that for all major emitting countries in the global south, such as Brazil, India, China, Mexico, South Africa, and even some LDCs, you see that the peak pretty much happens to happen now when we have a linear decline. So this is essentially what the science is saying, is that we must have, even under those particular circumstances, a peak and linear decline. We also looked at if we have a global carbon budget of 750 gigatons for 2 degrees, it would be less for 1.5 degrees. What would South Africa's carbon budget be in it? And that works out to, depending on how you calculate it and under what sort of ethical circumstances, somewhere between 5 gigatons and 16 gigatons. Well, what does that mean in terms of a peak and decline and trajectory? Well, that means probably you have to peak somewhere about now, where we are today, which, according to the Department of Environment in NEDLAC earlier this year, was 542 megatons, and decline to somewhere around 70 megatons. And we make a series of recommendations about how Parliament should investigate this matter, come up with scientific review within 1 year, some of the near-term priorities of this white paper. But we also looked and said, well, we understand the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. We are totally in agreement with that constitutional principle, and quite frankly, the North should pay. However, we took the emissions pathway that was presented in the white paper, and you'll see this on page 9. There's a table of population emissions, upper limit, lower limit, and then per capita emissions. And you'll see where our per capita emissions will be based upon in 2050, and they range from 7.5 tons per person to 3.74 tons. We contrasted against that with what is in the LTMS required by science scenario, which was the last major scientific study on the matter here done domestically, and you see the ranges between 4.72 and 5.53 tons. Well, what happens if you look on page 10, if that is applied to similar countries in the BRICS, so China, India, Brazil, Russia, and Mexico, these are comparable countries. These are countries which have had their own development channel challenges, who are large degrees of poverty, inequality, and are comparable countries to us. We've also applied to join the BRICS, so it must not be such a bad thing. Anyway, if you look on that table, on the lower limit that was presented in the white paper, the peak and decline plan, those five countries, China, India, Brazil, Russia, and Mexico, if they produce the same amount of per capita emissions that we suggest is a fair emissions for South Africa, and no other country in the world produced any emissions, LDCs, advanced countries, even South Africa, they would burn through that 750 gigatons on 2050 levels in 57 years. And on the upper limit, that goes to 28 years. So essentially what we're saying in the pathway is that we are somehow different from Chinese, Russians, Mexicans, Brazilians, and Indians. If we have an emissions pathway of X, it surely must be, in order for it to be fair, it must be reputable by countries similar to us. And this is not the case. So if we go ahead with this carbon pathway as presented in the white paper, the only way the globe could keep to a 1.5 or even 2 degree warming and thus prevent the devastation which is undoubtedly will rain upon Southern Africa is that other countries, LDCs and other developing countries, would have to take much sharper cuts. So effectively, they would have to eat into their own carbon space to take up our carbon space, which is not fair. And this has been the argument of what the North has done, so we would be replicating that argument and those bad practices there.
You've got 4 minutes.
I've got 4 minutes. Well, then I will quickly shift to carbon taxation, which I'm sure you'll hear much about. I will quickly mention the conditional nature. We don't think it's in line with the Constitution, and we would suggest that it would be redrafted in the actual white paper. We'll take questions on that. Carbon taxation is a very important tool to use. We think it's a very good idea that Treasury has done it, and we're very happy that Treasury has considered carbon trading as a bad system. It is not one system that will work. However, we need to make some specific interventions with Treasury on this matter. And one of them is how the tax will be implemented. If we take who actually produces emissions in this country, and that's Sasol and Eskom, they account for about 56% of the emissions. So any climate change reduction will have to deal with those two companies. One of the problems is that these companies operate in very regulated markets that are inelastic, and essentially if you buy electricity, you have no choice but to buy electricity from Eskom, And likewise, if you buy liquid fuels, you'll be buying fossil fuels, especially since fuels are all mixed up anyway. And the demand for these is quite inelastic. So effectively what happens is the carbon tax gets passed on to these companies. They will then pass it on through to consumers, and NERSA has allowed Eskom to pass through costs. In effect, then that means the citizens of this country pay for corporations to make profit, and yet the emissions profile won't reduce because the corporations will continue to make profit. And the level of carbon taxation would have to be so high in the case of Sasol, which makes about 400 grand per ton of carbon emitted in profit, that that would probably break every other aspect of the economy, not to make it uneconomical for Sasol. So essentially, but because they're regulated markets and those prices are determined by government, it is quite simple to not let Sasol and Eskom pass on through those costs, and we think that would be a presumption. We agree completely that this should be ring-fenced. Is one way of getting public acceptance into the matter. You know your money is going to a solution. It's not going to the general fiscus, and we give arguments why that's a good idea, and I suggest you read it. I would like to mention carbon capture and storage, like my colleague at Greenpeace. We don't think that carbon capture and storage should be given the prominence that it is. We do have research on the matter that's come from the Carbon Atlas that was led by Tony Surge, and it proves that in South Africa, the only places we could theoretically deposit the carbon would be off the coast of Durban and down near Mossgas. That would mean we would have to pipe liquefied carbon dioxide from the Highveld all the way down to Durban and then stick it under the ground, even if that worked. That would be an incredibly expensive process, and the energy penalty on that would be very high. It's all purely theoretical at the moment, in which we'd probably have to build three coal-fired power stations. Well, for every three coal-fired power stations with CCS, we'd have to build a fourth just to power the CCS. So there are better ways of doing it, and we shouldn't put our hopes on it, which is what Treasury seems to do in its carbon taxation. And then as a final sort of comment, climate change is often a very scary event, and it is a very scary event, and it prevents significant amounts of challenges, and a lot of those are very scary challenges. We have to do something which has never really been done in human society before, and we have to change the basic energy system, which has served us quite nicely since the Industrial Revolution. And people tend to back away from that because it does sound like a very, very big challenge. It is also a significant opportunity to address a lot of the social justice and inequalities that exist in our society. And a very simple example is public transport. We need to reduce our emissions in the transport sector. Better public transport schemes are to the benefit of our people, many of whom pay half their salary just to get to work and back again. Other examples are coal-fired power stations are nasty for anyone who lives anywhere near them, and so they get significant health impacts. So there's a lot of things we can do to change how our economy works to the betterment of the populace, because it obviously is not working so great for the populace at the moment with 1 million jobs last year. This is an opportunity to both meet those social issues, to ensure that there is actually economic freedom in the country, and solve an environmental problem. So it's actually a win-win, though it will mean that vested interests will probably have to take a back seat. And I will open up for questions.
Thank you. That is good timing. Just on time. Questions? A lot of the same issues raised, so you can now tackle them from all angles. Mr. Morgan, any further questions? No. Mr. Skosana? Dr. Huang? Ms. Bengu? Mr. Kalala? Mr. Morgan?
Oh, thanks. I think the presentation is very clear. Thank you for that. I think your submissions on the science and the trajectory are an excellent contribution to this process. I am particularly interested in your recommendations on how you would structure, for example, a scientific advisory panel, how you would feed it into the decision-making process. It's important that we engage on institutional arrangements around climate change. And as you said, getting the science right and getting the policy to respond to the science is very, very important. So how would Earthlife Africa see that? What would need to be done? The implication, of the presentation is that there isn't transparency often on how, for example, policymakers get to certain decisions. So give us some thoughts on that. I'd appreciate those. Thank you.
Just let me understand what the two of you are saying. Are you saying that the white paper as it stands now, when it comes to mitigation and having set out the trajectory which they've explained to us, falls within the scientific? You're saying that that's wrong. That's false. You're saying that the white paper is false. Am I understanding you correctly? No, I mean, you made the same point, but... I'm trying to understand. There's a whole explanation given. This thing has been taken through all processes to say that we're falling within those promises we've made, falling within the scientific band that we have to, and this is the way we're going to do it. We're just going to do it through a trajectory, not a flat line, is the position. And it seems to me from what you're saying here, if I'm understanding you correctly with all this stuff, you're saying that's wrong. It's false. The people are lying. The white paper is lying to us. Just explain a lie to us. I think that will be useful. Let me see if others have got other issues before I get Mr. Morgan.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm also interested in the response to your question there, Chairperson. I understand what you're saying about the fact that the peak should be imminent. Practically now, if not now, then very, very soon, that the white paper doesn't own up to that and in fact puts it some years in the distance still. And I think what you're saying is that there should be a sort of linear decline quite quickly. What is your response then to the feasibility of the transition? Because I may accept fully that what you're saying is quite correct. And if that's the case, then my natural response to you would be, well, is it feasible that we as a country can actually make that transition that quickly, taking into account the fact that high carbon intensity industries would have a certain amount of job shocks. I accept that new jobs will be created in new sectors, and that's certainly very, very exciting. But isn't actually what the white paper is doing is saying we have to actually transition and allow for the necessary processes to be put in place. Now, I accept that you might very well come back to me and say, well, the science says what it says, and we just have to do that because, of course, we put at risk then reaching the tipping point, which is runaway climate change. And if that's your answer, you know, please present it that way. But I would just see, I don't see how it's possible to immediately respond to the peak that even the science says is imminent and which you reinforce here. We have to surely manage the response to climate change in a way that takes into account the jobs in our economy and what is feasible about basically introducing all the various components of a green economy. Thanks.
Towards the end of your input, you said something is unconstitutional. I couldn't... It was either carbon budgets or carbon tax or something like that. I couldn't particularly get it. If you did say something like it, just repeat it for me. Let me just see what it is you said. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Taylor, over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for those comments. They're very interesting questions, and I think they definitely need answers. On the scientific advisory panel, our recommendation is quite quick. Simply put, that this committee do it in a public and transparent manner. You all are elected by the citizens of the country, which includes us, to effectively solve the problems. I mean, you're our mandated representatives. How would that composition look? It would be, I think, in order for it to come to the appropriate scientific conclusions, it would have to be a scientific body, not a industry scientific body or an NGO scientific body. I mean, please don't put us on your committee, okay, because we would believe that would be you get our perspective, and you know, we want it to be as neutral as science could possibly be, and that the results of that advisory committee actually be peer-reviewed in scientific papers. The peer review process is an incredibly powerful process. And so where I have used peer review information in this submission. So that is how I would do it. And the idea is that really that we are putting forward is that as a near-term plan is that Parliament devises this committee. I mean, why should Parliament actually accept what the Department of Environmental Affairs actually says? It should do its own independent research. And within a year, come up with the scientific wisdom of it, and that might answer to some of your questions earlier. So that would be how we would envisage a scientific advisory panel, but I mean, it would be ultimately up to this committee. The feasibility of the transition and the necessary processes and the ability to peak and decline. On one hand, South Africa is not very blessed in that situation. We have an incredibly high fossil fuel base, and we have a lot of energy inefficient industries. Many of them who are designed actually not to use electricity for the most optimal use, but to actually just soak up excess electricity, aluminium smelting, for example. However, we need to change that system anyway. And this is actually one of the things that's working in our favor. Our coal fire base and a lot of our coal reserves, especially within the near power stations, are all coming to an end. So come 2025 to 2020, we'll be replacing coal-fired power stations anyway. So we are about to make one way or another, whether you think climate change is a great idea, let's bring it on, or you want to solve it, we will be spending an awful lot of state expenditure on generation. So really what we have to do now is shift the way we do the expenditure, and that's where it is. We may, if we wish to follow the scientific route, which we strongly advocate for, and have a much sharper decline without the plateau, it may mean we'll have to idle down some coal-fired power stations. So run them not at 80 or 90% capacity, as they do now, but they run at 50% capacity. So Eskom burns less coal as a matter of transition. It will mean that we will have to adopt some very quick power solutions, depending on who talks, and I'm going to sort of step away a little bit from Earth life here, there are scenarios which would include a much larger percentage of gas-fired power stations. I mean, they are gazetted actually in the IRP too. I'm not making this stuff up, it's gazetted by government. So there are a variety of different mechanisms, but it will require a very concerted effort. I think any person who comes to a committee like this and says, let's reduce our carbon emissions is going to be easy, is completely lying through their teeth. It would be an incredibly difficult task. I saw a documentary the other day with James Woosley, who's not someone I would usually quote. He's an ex-CIA director under Bush 1 and went off and assassinated people all over the world, launched wars. But he did make an interesting point, is that the United States, in the process of 3 years and 8 months in World War II, transitioned from a peacetime economy to an economy that churned out vast amounts of technical goods, fought wars on three continents, and defeated fascism. I went on. But the point behind that statement and that little antidote, I guess, is that what it requires is a significant level of political will and state intervention. Essentially, we need to be making as a country, like every country in the world does. I mean, many of my comments could be applied equally to China or America or the EU. We need to actually say, this is what we're going to do. It's sort of like we need to take what we did during the World Cup, in which we showed how we can significantly reach particular targets very quickly, on time, efficiently, and everybody says, great job. We need to actually do the same thing with our economy. So it is a massive transition. It is possible. It is not going to be easy. And it means we will have to take painful choices. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have to actually decide what we do with Sasol. You know, Sasol produces about 70, roughly speaking, 70 megatons of carbon dioxide every year, which is where we would have to end up as a country. So somewhere between now and 2050, SASL will have to be dealt with. Petrus A would probably have to be dealt with. And I don't know very well the amounts of revenue that they bring to Treasury. So somewhere along the line, we have to make that revenue from these old industries plus environmental health, social health choice. And so I'm glad I'm not in your position, actually. I mean, it's much nicer to be an activist on the outside and say, rah, rah, bad, bad, bad. But you're the ones who are going to have to make those hard decisions as mandated by the Constitution. And on that point, I'm going to go to the issue of the Constitution. We take the view that the Bill of Rights is not a conditional set of rights. It's not you don't get free speech if, or that. So we take the view of the environment, though this has not been tested in the courts, I will grant that, that the right to a clean, healthy environment is not a conditional right for South Africans. It's unconditional. It's inalienable. It's one of those great things that we got from liberation. So when we talk about a conditionality of reducing carbon emissions, that doesn't seem to line up from the constitutional mandate to avoid climate change. It's no climate finance whatsoever. No technological transfer comes, which we think should happen. I'm not arguing that it shouldn't happen. But even if any of those don't think, if all the money and all the goodies and everything else goes to, say, Zambia, for example, we should still do this. Even if the UNFCCC, in its final deal, writes in, South Africa will not receive any money or technology transfer. Now, I doubt that would happen, but even if it does, we would argue quite strongly that the Constitution would mandate us as a country to ensure that we have a clean, safe environment. So that is our point on the conditionality.
I think you should go and look. I agree with your conclusions. I just don't agree with your viewing of the Constitution. Constitution is the right. No right is absolute. There's a limitation clause that allows you to limit any right to the extent that other democracies do it. And in that context, that legal argument of yours would not be correct. But what you, the other things you're arguing, the result of it, that we should not be bound by whether, I'm not going to argue with that because I agree with you. But on the Constitution, I think there's not much to argue. I think you go to court and get us a precedent if you've got enough money to do so. But I think we realize, the Constitution your rights can't be absolute. Otherwise, if you've got two rights that clash, and that's why we've got a limitation clause, Section 36, in our Constitution, which allows you to limit rights to the extent that other democracies do it. So if we're doing something that other democracies don't do, well, then we're in trouble. If we don't do that, then we're always within the rights of limiting the rights. But and there's a whole lot of judgments written by the Constitutional Court. They have been tested. A whole lot of written, starting with the death penalty one, right through to the most recent equality ones, all deal with the limitation clause.
Onto the issues of is it wrong in the inadequacy of the emissions? Has governments lied to us? We take the view that a mistake has been made, and that's one of the views, I think, and purposes of having public hearings, is that if we believe that a mistake has been made in the paper, that that be then given to the relevant decision makers, i.e. yourselves, in order to deal with that mistake. So we do believe that there has been a mistake. I mean, I would probably say it was not exactly a lie. I mean, that might be a very strong term to use, but we don't think it is right. Now, we're saying don't believe us that it's right or wrong. I don't think that you should believe us. So that's why we give a series of recommendations on what Mr. Morgan had to say was, you know, conduct those research yourself.
But what I want to know is, they have now, from the green paper to the white paper, gone and give us a trajectory and show that trajectory meets the scientific normative that we have to reach. Are you saying that that whole trajectory is false, it's wrong?
We say yes. I mean, essentially that.
And what is wrong?
Well, that's why, because the trajectory is based, well, it's how you would calculate it starts off with what is you think your future emissions will be. I mean, that's effectively the South African's government's approach, and the approach of many governments across the world, to reducing emissions. There have been political commitments that have interfered with that. But essentially you're saying we're going to produce very high emissions, we will reduce percentages off that at points in the future, and that is the key thing. That is a different approach than from assigning a carbon budget. So what we're talking about here is two different methodological approaches to ensuring emissions. Now, the carbon budget approach is a very good approach. It is a very sound scientific approach which we've sought to use in the domestic sphere. We think that the problem has come is that we're not using the carbon budget approach as a country as an entirety based within a much larger carbon budget.
Let me just understand you. You say that that trajectory they're giving us is wrong, and the reason it's wrong is because the amount of emissions they assume is wrong.
It's too high.
It's too high.
That's why I made a big deal, if you'll permit me, Chair, about what is fair. On one way, logically speaking, it is not too high because you could assume that other countries, and I'm not talking developed world countries, I'm talking about other developing countries, could eat that space up. So you could possibly keep to 2 degrees, but it would mean that we would be enforcing greater cuts than what we are prepared to put on ourselves, and greater cuts which are largely considered to be what would be fair under common but differentiated responsibilities on other countries. So
are you saying that because we base it on 2%, and we start with our emissions too high, that what is given in the white paper is incorrect?
A 2 degrees, you mean?
The target of 2 degrees.
Yeah, okay.
That the target of 2 degrees is wrong, because you say 1.5, so I understand that. That's, you know, one can debate that. But you're saying because we start with a 2% and we start with too high permission, it's those two factors that you say give us a false picture in the document.
Yeah, that's correct. But also, the calculations that you see in the examples that I use on a per capita basis, those are based off a 2 degree pathway. So essentially it's a little bit stronger than that in saying that on a 2 degree pathway, it's not right. It would definitely not be right on a 1 degree pathway. There's not, by logic, a chance.
What is the number of emissions that they base this on? And what do you want to see it?
Are you talking what of...
This projection they're making, yeah, you say is wrong because they are projecting too high emissions in the future. Therefore, they're getting it wrong. Now, I'm saying, what is it? What is your number that you say the department is using as being too high? And what is the number you would like it to see to actually reach the scientific target?
A peak now, to go to 70 megatons. I mean, that is the... a pathway which would probably keep...
Now being?
Today.
You want us to peak today?
Unfortunately.
With the economy that you've explained yourself, which is totally and utterly a fossil fuel-based economy, we must peak today.
Unfortunately so. When I looked at this, Chair, I mean, I can see the look of disbelief on your face. And we've had a good opportunity now that there has been numerical numbers. This debate should have happened in 2009, because there weren't numbers.
But it hasn't. It hasn't.
We're having it today.
Yeah.
We stood around and looked at this and said, oh no, because for precisely what you're saying, I'm not sugarcoating anything here today. I have never pretended that this will be an easy task, but this says if we take these carbon budgets, if those budgets hold, and you should definitely peer review my stuff or EarthLife stuff, but if that holds, this is what it means. Part of the problem here is that we are used as societies, I mean, of dealing with social political problems. And we've been very good at dealing with manners in a very social political way. We're great at that. We're wonderful at that. Climate change is a different kind of problem. It's an out of context problem. It's not something we're used to dealing with. One of the analogies that I do give is that, you know, I may be holding a TV in my hand and it's about to slip and it's going to land on my foot. Now, everybody might want that TV, or not, I mean, depending on what your viewpoint, but not want that TV to hit my foot. But that want, that desire, doesn't stop the TV from hitting my foot. It's the law of gravity. So what these are based on the laws of thermodynamics.
Do you accept that in all reality, the world's probably not going to peak for another decade? seeing as where we are at the moment with our international negotiations, which are just basically falling apart. I mean, you know, it's fine to say we must speak tomorrow, but
I think the world
is like years away from any agreement on any peaking.
One of the reasons why that may be the case, and one of the reasons why people have got very upset about the continued failures of COPs, and one of the reasons why civil society will engage in this COP, is that countries are all sitting below here. They all say, we've got to reduce our emissions, it's going to hurt our economies, we don't want to lose our competitive advantage. No country has actually stood up and said, you know what? We can't go on this anyway. We're going to do the hard cuts, and actually led by a moral force. Now, one of the great things about South Africa is that it actually does have that moral authority. And so I can't go advocate what Americans should do. I'm not an American. I'm not Chinese. I'm not Indian. I'm South Africa. So I can only advocate to my country what it should do. And that unless someone in this UNFCCC process actually stands up and says, chaps, this is what we have to do, and this is what we're going to do as a country, this process will be unbreakable. And if it is breakable, then all the things we talk about, and this goes back to Mr. Morgan's original point, our development, our education, our people's lives, livelihood, they all get obliterated. That was pretty clear in the science in the white paper. The irony is that Africans, who have traditionally produced least amounts of carbon dioxide, will be the ones who will be there during the time. And it will be in, well, I mean, I'm 35 now. I mean, I could possibly see this if I quit smoking. Which might be a good reason not to quit. But my daughter definitely will. So this is not an issue that's going to happen some long time. So,
you know, I understand you want us to peak tomorrow. What is the figure that the white paper presents that you're saying is too high, and what do you want to see that figure to be?
Well, the figure, sorry, let me just look it up. I want to give you the exact figure. The white paper talks about a peak in 2025 that plateaus till 2036 and then declines to in 2050. The numbers is 614 megatons on the upper limit and 389 megatons on the lower limit. And those then decline after a plateau to 2036 to 428 megatons in 2050 and 212 megatons in 2050 on the lower limit. So that's the South African emissions pathway. Now, one of the reasons why we're actually in this predicament as a country is back when they did the LTMS, they based all the reductions from what they call the baseline off the growth without constraints, as I'm sure you do know. I mean, I think it's page 6 of the LTMS or something like that. That growth without constraints, quite frankly, was never going to happen because of the things that were in there. It was like we were going to have 6 coal fire power stations, we'd have 5 new coal to liquids plants, we'd have some gas to liquids plants, etc. It was a development pathway which was put in as the worst case possible scenario if money and carbon were no object and no renewables came in whatsoever. Now, unfortunately, what it seems to have happened, according to the science, between when the LTMS came out in 2004 and what the carbon emissions that Department of Environment presented in NEDLAC earlier this year, is that our emissions have actually tracked growth without constraints. So we are now at 542. So we're now tracking the scenario which we thought back in 2004 was the most unrealistic scenario. So that's kind of like why we're in this situation, is that we've now been not doing litigation, so now that
what
makes it much
numbers?
Harder. Sorry?
What are your numbers you want to see it at?
If the department
has to calculate according to you, what is the number they must use to calculate?
Use a carbon budget of between 5 to 16 gigatons.
5 to 16 gigatons. Okay. And you say that they are using what?
Their carbon budget in here, if I remember doing the calculation, is not in my thing, so I think theirs is probably somewhere around the neighborhood of 25 gigatons would be their carbon budget, if I calculated that out correctly.
Okay.
So it's quite a big difference. my guess is in that 5 to 16 gigaton range, you're probably looking somewhere around 7 gigatons by the time you do the final calculations. Again, hopefully we will have a long opportunity to engage with these numbers on a more scientific basis. And
you have you looked at this explanation of these?
I have been presented that explanation at LESAC.
Okay, and you've looked at it and you still think it's wrong?
I still think it's wrong.
Okay, thank you. Are there any others you haven't answered?
No, I think that was
I think you've answered all of them, yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. I appreciate your time, your efforts. No. It's too late now. You must ask before we answer the questions. Dr. Huang, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Thank you for your time, effort. We'll probably engage at some stage again.
Thank you. I apologize. I must leave now.
Sorry?
I must leave now, but I apologize.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. There's no obligation to sit and listen to us. What's the time? Okay. Can we have the Environmental Monitoring Group, Mr. Tabang? I don't know how you pronounce this. In Ngozela. This is submission number 5. And there's a PowerPoint presentation. Good morning, sir. I hope you heard the procedure, 10 to 15 minutes. Make your major points, and we'll then engage you in questions. Thank you very much. Is it this one? No.
Thank you, sir.
It's like one like this. This is the slide presentation. Okay, go ahead.
EMG would like to congratulate the well-written comprehensive paper, you know, and we would like to support the overarching objectives to build the climate resilience of the country, its economy, and its people, and manage the just transition to a climate resilient and lower carbon economy and society. Some of the issues that I'm going to touch on relate to, one, the gap between policy vision and implementation. We feel that, like, you know, it needs to be, the white paper needs to be more clear in terms of the policy of vision and implementation. And we also feel that the conflict where growth strategy hits climate change needs to be looked at. You know, because some of the growth strategy, as my comrades and colleagues have alluded earlier on, some of the, like, you know, growth strategies that we have in the country conflict with the climate change realities. The green economy is insufficient to tackle sustainability issues, because a green economy could also be seen as the way, or as the same, in the same, like, you know, eyes of accumulating profits rather than, like, you know, looking at issues of sustainability. Publication on greenhouse emissions, we believe that it would be good if we can have a regular publication on greenhouse emissions, you know, as a country. On water, integration of water of climate change response into national water resource strategy and water for growth and development. You know, we have the national water resource strategy, which is presently under review, and we are not sure where the water for growth and development process is at this point. But the white paper, you know, relies on this two, like, you know, particular, like, you know, strategies, in particular the National Water Resource Strategy, which is not yet finalized, but in terms of addressing climate change issues related to water, it again, like, you know, relies on the National Water Resource Strategy. You know, we also therefore believe that the Parliament needs to play a much more stronger oversight role. you know, in terms of, you know, looking at different sector, like, you know, sector strategies, you know, your transport, like, you know, sector, your agricultural sector, and so on and so on. You know, we believe that, I mean, there are all these strategies, you know, or policy documents in place, and in order for them to be properly aligned, in order to be focused on addressing a runaway climate change, you know, the Parliament have to play a much more, like, stronger oversight role. The water demand management should also focus on saving water by big users and not punish the poor. Now, for example, in the city of Cape Town, we found that, or in the rest of the Western Cape and some parts of the country, you know, measures to deal with water demand management, you know, are measures that threatens, you know, the access, like, you know, by poor communities in particular, into clean drinking water, and allow the big water users to continue polluting water. So we think this should be looked at. Treatment works system should link to generation of alternative energy such as biogas. You know, we have, like, in particular, I mean, at municipal level, we have great problems where municipalities are unable to deal with their wastewater. You know, and when we look at this, wastewater could also be used to generate, like, you know, alternative energy, which would in turn benefit, you know, municipalities and communities. Rainwater harvesting, the white paper does mention, you know, the need for rainwater harvesting, but we also observe that the white paper doesn't really, like, you know, talk about a comprehensive rainwater harvesting strategy. It only, like, you know, goes as far as rainwater tanks. You know, there's other methods that could be used, you know, in capturing water from the rain, which could be used for various, like, you know, purposes. You know, windmills and water pumps should be serviced and maintained to supplement water, in particular in rural communities. You know, if like, you know, one goes to the old Bantu stands, you know, you'll find that that old infrastructure which was there during that time, you know, before 1994, have been left to decay. You know, it's not serviced. And this water, as much as, like, you know, government have introduced clean drinking water, you know, and helping people to move away from relying on these resources, but we also believe that this these resources could help in providing water, in particular in supplementing, you know, water needs by rural communities for farming and agricultural purposes. climate change is about people and their capacity. It's about, I mean, it's about people and their capacity to be able to adapt. You know, it's not only about technical solutions. You know, as the previous presenters have correctly said that we need to invest on people's capacity to understand how climate change is going to impact on their lives and their environment. So it should not just be about bringing about solutions which are only in technical in nature. It should be about people building their own capacity and adapting, like, you know, capacity. Adaptation Network, which was formed just after the Climate Change Summit, we see it as a space, like, you know, that provides itself where, like, you know, different role players, like, you know, including non-state sectors, such as big business, civil society, etc., could, like, you know, come together and work together in trying to find solutions, you know, to problems that we are faced with. You know, support for small-scale farmers should be prioritized. You know, the white paper does recognize the role that is played by small-scale farmers in particular, you know, in sustaining environment and also providing food security. But we also believe that, you know, some of the solutions, you know, that already exist, which are like your organic farming, you know, your agricultural methods which utilizes like, you know, less pesticides and herbicides, you know, should be, like, you know, prioritized, you know, and support for small-scale farmers, including for water, because it's one of the things that they struggle with, you know, at times. You know, and also the need for capacity building and research, you know, in order to better understand, like, you know, for them to better understand how climate change is going to impact on their agricultural practices. Support for civil society institutions that are already, like, you know, doing awareness and consciousness, like, you know, broadening, you know, programs in communities should be upscaled, like, you know, by government. No, because at times these institutions lack resources to be able to do, like, you know, the work that they are doing. You know, because we all understand that government cannot be able to do other things, and this is where civil society organizations or institutions come in, you know, in terms of building a greater awareness around climate change issues at a very grassroots level. Low impact technology for rural communities, you know, in particular for coastal communities who rely on fisheries, you know, those who rely on agricultural, like, you know, practices, you know, and they really require, like, you know, greater capacity in order to be able to understand, you know, how climate change is going to impact on them, and low technological impact, like, you know, types of initiatives should be upscaled in these communities, and we should not just rely on high technology, like, you know, types of solutions. Participation is a requirement for capacity building. You know, if these communities in coastal areas and also in rural communities, including in peri and urban setups, you know, are not involved in any strategies that, you know, are being developed by a government, in particular by local government, you know, then it would be impossible for them to build their capacity so as to be able to engage with climate change issues, you know, and be able to resist and adapt to climate change. That is something that happens. Sorry, Chair. The white paper also does speak to issues of capacity building and modeling techniques and scenarios and early warning systems and their effective dissemination to agricultural and agricultural sector, in particular small-scale farmers. I've already, like, you know, alluded to this point, but I think it is important that these early warning systems or these research outcomes should be disseminated to these countries so that they are able to adapt, you know. And successful adaptation is also about people's capacity and not just about goods and services. The focus on education and awareness has welcomed. However, it is essential that government extension workers are also educated and trained, not only in essential, not only in elements of climate change and agricultural adaptation process, but also in participatory community facilitation. Because we find that if we don't have this community participatory processes where people are able to engage in doing research, like, you know, their own community research, and be able to use and disseminate that research, like, you know, within their communities. Government should also support many civil society institutions who are already running these programs successfully. On human settlements, the challenges of human settlements are well articulated. Unfortunately, the recommended responses, which are primarily technical, do not address the identified challenges. In particular, the second and third challenge linked to inter of city services delivery mechanism and interference between residents and their environment. These are challenges that cannot be dealt with through technical models, tools, design, technology. Responses alone promoting behavioral change is an important idea. However, it is insufficient to balance technical interventions because in practices, it usually means sending people lots of information about what they should do differently in the hope that they will change. The change is to find ways to shift the relationship. We believe that relationship building between the Ekono institutions, in particular between government, civil society, and other Ekono sectors, like, you know, of the economy, it's quite essential, because it is not just about sending extension workers, but it's also about relationship building between various Ekono sectors of our economy and people. Human settlements and rural settlements addresses the need for research and development of low-impact technologies for rural communities. Many such technologies already exist: wind and solar pumping, organic pest control, rainwater harvesting, and can begin to be immediately implemented with appropriate incentives, subsidies, and dedicated extension services. On coastal settlements, I've already touched on this. On biofuels mitigation potential, the very worry of growing crops for cars, thing rather of maintaining from wastewater treatment or using only crop waste for biodiesel. Near-term priority flagship programs. There are programs that government can upscale, the flagship programs, which could be your alternative energies, your rainwater harvesting, etc. Recovering energy from wastewater treatment works, inclusion of algal technology are inventions that are easy to implement in the immediate term. These are all the things that government should be looking at upscaling in the short and mid-term. They should form an integral part of renewable energy flagship programs, waste management flagship programs. This will address the issue of poor wastewater treatment, at the same time reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It is unclear from the white paper what the relative priority of flagship projects is and what budget is to be allocated to each of them. So it would be important to have some budgets assigned for these flagship projects so that they can be upscaled within the short period. Roles and institutional arrangement. Parliament needs to play a stronger oversight role in ensuring that what is agreed here is done and timeframes are met. It is said that the department or the institutions that are responsible for managing our water resources, there is about 183 institutions. And then the National Department of Water Affairs is in a process of looking at institutional realignment, but this process is taking much time. If we're saying our water resources are under threat, or we are heading for water crisis, or we have a water crisis, and at the same time we don't have adequate institutional rearrangement.
But 1 minute left.
Then it's going to be problematic. In conclusion, we need to mobilize adequate financing for climate change, adaptation and resilience by poor communities in particular.
Thank you. I think that's a good exposition of getting the balance right between capacitating communities to be able to respond to climate change and actually doing the technical side of it. I think that's a good exposition of it. We're going to adjourn shortly. For those of you that want to go to dark places, please do so. Those of you that want to drink tea or coffee, please do so. For those of you who want to do both, please do it quickly. We'll be back here in about 10 minutes, okay?
Yeah.
presentation.
I got your email at 11.
Yeah, and then what I forgot to do was to print it out for myself as my notes. So I had to go back to work this morning to do that.
Thank you.
Please get in so we can start. It's the longest 5 minutes you've ever taken, huh? Can we just wish Mr. Greiling welcome? He arrived at the tea break. Mr. Greiling, please liberally use of the food of this committee. Right, we're going to start with questions to the Environmental Monitoring Group. 11:35. Any questions? Dr. Huang? No? Dr. Huang, no. Mr. Skosana? No. Mr. Morgan? No. Mr. Greiling? No. So he wasn't just brought here to question you. Ms. Dlamini? No. Can I ask you, you made a statement here, which I find a bit cryptic. The green economy is insufficient to tackle sustainability issues. What do you mean by that? I think the other things you said are quite simple, they're quite straightforward, but very important in the sense of trying to get that balance right. But those are, of course, very practical things that have to be done. That's the only issue that kind of struck me. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Thank you, Chair. It simply means that, you know, the way a green economy is presented, you know, it doesn't really address the issues of long-term sustainability. We are moving towards a green economy, you know, not because it will sustain, like, you know, our environment, because it will continue to make profits, like, you know, for those who are interested in profit making, without really looking at issues of workers. We might have a green economy, but the economy could still be an exploitative, like, you know, type of economy where workers are subjected to low wages, like, you know, and inadequate, like, you know, working conditions, etc.
Oh, so what you mean is capitalism is insufficient to tackle sustainability issues.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, because why I ask you is that there's a whole, you know, we were worried under the green paper that this thing, green economy, is seen as some little pimple there seen sitting at part of the economy. And that actually it's the other way around. The economy must integrate itself into the environment, not the environment integrate itself into the a part of the economy. And there's a whole section here on mainstreaming climate resilient development, and a whole lot of issues have been raised. But obviously capitalism and socialism is not one of the issues, so I think your point is slightly different on it. Okay, now I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. Although I must tell you, there are many socialist countries that have probably got the worst environmental records you could ever imagine. The socialist countries are not exactly the epitome of environmental friendly societies. I think we should just dispel that one as well. But I know what you're saying is that when the thing is profit driven, then clearly whether the priorities of the people are being met is a different issue. It's the priorities of making profit that's being met, and not necessarily. Sometimes they may dissect, but many times your argument is that they don't dissect. And you'll only get people developing that part of the green economy that makes money for them, and not the ones that are integrating. I think I understand what the point you're making.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Now, I think your input's very clear. I found it very balanced and clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next input is from WWF, Ms. Nordia. If you can take the hot seat, please. You know the drill. 10 to 15 minutes. Welcome. Thank you for being here. May God bless you.
honourable members in the House, thank you for having us. I'm going to assume that people have read our written submission, and I'm really going to zoom in on some very key things we'd like to highlight. We're very pleased that the white paper is out before COP17, and we are encouraged by much that is in the white paper. And there are really two areas we want to look at. The one is the area of emissions and the trajectory, and the other is the issue of climate-resilient development. And then we'll end with things that we think are really quite good breakthroughs in the white paper. Okay, so this is a graph of the trajectory, I can't say it very well, in the white paper. So in the middle is a blue line, and that is the line that ever since the long-term mitigation scenarios came out is the line that South Africa has been speaking about. The Department of Environmental Affairs, the energy experts that they've drawn on at the Energy Research Center at UCT, civil society has understood that to be the line. But the problem is that, as the colleague from EarthLife was saying, is that our trajectory has already been going high. So some people are now arguing that that white line, that blue line is not what we should be looking at. And I want to say that this is actually a political issue. It's not a numbers issue. There are people in whose, there are vested interests who want that line to be higher, because they do not want to make the hard economic choices that will be required, and it will cut into their business model if they are given less space to emit. So what the white paper does is it defines a range of emissions rather than a line. And the top line there, the green one, is the top of the white paper's range, and the orange one is the bottom of the white paper's range. So WWF won't say that the white paper's wrong. It's not wrong. It says we could develop our emissions trajectory between that top line and bottom line. That's not wrong. It's just not ambitious enough, precisely because of the kinds of things Tristan Taylor was presenting, that the carbon budget issue. So if I can just spend a couple of minutes explaining the difference between a methodology that is cuts off a top line and a carbon budget approach. And in fact, a lot of the numbers that Tristan was working from come from a WWF study on the carbon budget. So a carbon budget approach looks like at it like this. It says, looking at the relationship between how much we emit and the temperature, if we want to stay at most at 2 degrees global average increase, this is how much we can afford to emit. So if you imagine a sort of big black plastic bag full of greenhouse gases, which we are still allowed to emit if we want to stay below 2 degrees, that's our carbon budget. Then you go to international political negotiations and you try to carve up that carbon budget between countries. And the study that Tristan was referring to, WWF looked at a whole lot of different ways of carving up that carbon budget and the implications for countries' budgets, you know, on the principle of a fair and equitable cut up of that budget. So dividing the global carbon budget up into countries' budget is a political negotiation. However, South Africa has committed to something different. We've said this is where we see our emissions going. It was called the long-term mitigation scenarios had a lot of different scenarios. One of them was this rampant growth without constraints. We don't try to do anything. We go full out, etc. But even that was not actually the business as usual line. The business as usual line has remained quite undefined right through all these green paper processes, the IRP2 process, etc. And we've repeatedly been calling for, so if we're going to cut minus so much percent by such a date. Off what top line is that? What is the business as usual line that you're working with? And so we really welcome that the white paper is now actually defining a range in numbers that can give the economy and business and all stakeholders some kind of surety and predictability that people can plan around. But we do agree with the argument presented by EarthLife in one way, in that it's far too unambitious. So you can go higher, you can peak later. The problem is you ultimately have to get down to that purple line called required by science. So the later you leave it and the higher you go, it's just going to get harder and harder. And to a point where it's almost impossible and you're sitting at 2 degrees. So really what EarthLife was arguing is that looking at where we need to get to and how much time we've got to do it, we've got to start, you know, peaking today and reducing. We're slightly more realistic about that. We acknowledge that we've already done certain things in South Africa that are going to push our emissions up. We also acknowledge that we do have developmental challenges that we will still need to use carbon emissions on, that you can't shift an economy, you know, from today off a coal-fired base or a coal-intensive base. So we say that we will really need, and this is based on where the global need to peak and then our fair share of that, we need to peak at 2025. Because it's not only a matter of how high you peak, but also how long you stay at that peak. And the white paper is allowing us to stay at that peak for, you know, from 2025 to 2035 and on the low range from 2020 to 2035. The longer you stay at a high peak, the more emissions you're putting out into the atmosphere, and it's the cumulative emissions in the atmosphere that cause climate change. So it's not only how high you go, but how long and more you put out there. So we would still say that the blue line is doable and is realistic, and that it gives us developmental space to peak. And we really think the absolute outer limit of peaking need not go beyond 550, and that still allows for you know, continuing to use coal-fired power and even building another Kusile, and recognizing that it takes time to get the energy efficiencies and the demand issues sorted out in the economy. And it's going to cost more the later we wait. Also, it's a matter of intergenerational equity. So we can say, okay, we'll just ride along for a while, not take it too seriously, not start acting tomorrow. It just means we push the problem onto future generations and make it harder for them. So we also say that we really have to start declining from 2025. The world carbon budget, as calculated by WWF, based on a 2-degree trajectory, I mean a 2-degree global increase, is 1,600 billion tons from 1990 to 2100, of which we've already used a lot. So we only have 870 billion tons left for 2009 to 2100, and we already passed 2009, and we don't seem to be peaking our emissions anywhere in the world, we're just increasing. So I think the point is that we can't peak today, but we can start immediately from today making the kinds of decisions that shift us to a low carbon economy. And that is what we would encourage the parliamentary committee to look into. Okay, so this is just some of the stuff I've already said, actually. That's our budget over the 1990 to 2100. But we've already used up a lot of it. And some of the implications of this. So given that South Africa isn't, we're not carving up the global budget between countries at the UNFCCC yet, we hope we'll get there, but South Africa has made commitments off a baseline to reduce emissions. In a sense, we could call that our carbon budget. If we take a business as usual line and then how much space, and we take the cuts, how much emissions does that allow us? But the thing is, there are really people in whose interest it is to push the business as usual line up, and we think that some of those interests have come into play in the white paper, and we're concerned about it. Anyway, it does seem to me that government is providing, and particularly Parliament actually, is providing great leadership in this issue, and your own chairperson has posed it very clearly.
Who the hell is that?
Yes.
Did I say that?
You were quoted in the Engineering News as saying this. Take it up with them if you're wrong.
Must be something that Scott knew or Shireen wrote.
So some of the flagship programs in the white paper seem to us to be a bit less ambitious than they could be. We really think, for example, that the renewable energy ambition of South Africa, whether it's in the Department of Energy, within ESCOM, within the Energy Portfolio Committee, the RP2, we really can spend the billions and trillions that we are going, that we, people say we must spend on coal-fired power stations or on nuclear, we can really spend them in the right place, where we ultimately will have to go anyway, and we really think you could accelerate renewable energy. And some of the flagship programs are a little bit a plan to make a plan rather than getting going on plans. So I think what we would encourage is that in the rollout of the white paper, the portfolio committee exercises your influence and your strategic direction that you can give to government to really see that those things are bedded down as proper plans, not just plans to make plans. Okay, then turning to an element of the green paper that we, a bit sad, has dropped out in the white paper, the issue of climate resilient development. And being the organization that we are, we would argue that you get climate resilient development when you take an ecosystems-based approach to development. At the heart of all economic activity and our survival on the planet is the services that ecosystems deliver to us. And I think that this portfolio committee and the Department of Environmental Affairs are in a difficult position because, you know, other arms of government, other departments and portfolio committees are tasked to do things like industrial development. And then this committee is tasked to lead on the environmental issues and almost be the champion and the safeguard for that. And it's actually an integral role, which is often seen as an add-on. So we would hope that your work could be strengthened. And we believe that there are not Mickey Mouse, but real economic solutions to going forward with low carbon and climate resilient, and I would skip through a few. We do a lot of work around sustainable agriculture, and there's lots of practices there that can assist around sustainable fisheries. If our fish in the sea collapse, that is going to have an enormous impact on our economy, on livelihoods, on food security. We did a life cycle analysis of dairy, and that's a mapping of the emissions. So it's from, you know, growing the feed for the cows up to the consumer, you and I, putting it in our fridge and using it and then throwing the packaging away. And you can see that a staggering amount of, you know, up to 59% of the greenhouse gas emissions in that chain actually comes on the farm. It is partly through the cow farts, which account for between 28 and 43% of the total. There's a lot of energy used for the irrigation, pumping of water for using electricity, and the source of feed, whether you're shipping it in, growing it locally or whatever. So looking at the water issue, we also did a water analysis of that life cycle, and you know, the information is in the PowerPoint presentation's notes. But we're busy now with a coal and water case study, because one of the things that, as everyone is very aware, that climate is going to impact on severely is water. So when we're looking at these hard choices that have to be made in moving to a low-carbon, climate-resilient economy, the issue is going to be trade-offs. There's not going to be any solution that's easy, and there's often not going to be a solution that, you know, leaves a clear way ahead. One's going to make decisions between what's the least worst decision in some cases. And we think that if you don't build ecosystems into the heart of those decisions, we're going to make misguided decisions. So there are some facts and figures about the impact, the interrelationship between coal and water and the problems there. And to skip through very quickly an example of this kind of decision making where one might make the wrong ones if we're not thinking about ecosystems. So here's an area in KwaZulu-Natal and going into Mpumalanga and so on, which is providing water. It's a water catchment area for all of those, the Tukela, the Vaal, the Pongola. In other words, it's satisfying the water needs of Gauteng and Durban. And in addition to the water, the provincial governments themselves have identified these as areas of high biodiversity importance. And you can see the dark green, those tiny little bits, are where it's already a protected area. And the orange and red is where they say, the red is, it's an irreplaceable area for biodiversity, or significant area for biodiversity. And that's where we're looking at mining licenses. So the dark red is mining applications, which have been submitted and are in the process of being looked at. Prospecting applications is the beigeish color, and then there are the light one is where they're pending prospecting applications. And I think if one looks at the overlay of these three, I mean, we can see that we're starting to look at mining in areas which are going to destroy water for ourselves. So, and there are other areas, you know, where we could mine coal without this level of impact on water and biodiversity. So that's the kind of decisions we have to look at. And I think there are organizations involved in this arena, including ourselves. There is scientific studies about it. So we could, be making very much better decisions. And I think that I'm very encouraged by the Steering Committee in Parliament on Climate Change, which will cross-cut. Also, you know, we've got to make better use of our clusters and our interministerial committees and so on. And the White Paper is encouraging in that regard, that there will be alignment and integration across government arenas. So these are the things we think are real cause for celebration in the White Paper. And actually, you know, what is really for us a breakthrough is this approach to the carbon budget approach, which just has to now be seriously looked at in terms of that trajectory range, and that we're going to move to carbon budgets or carbon reduction outcomes, which we would interpret as targets, for every sector, that it's going to move from voluntary to mandatory, and that there's a 2-year process to determine all of these. We welcome the carbon tax, and we're glad to note that there will be means to offset the burden on the poor that might create. We're very thrilled about the flagship programs, just noting that we shouldn't wait for endless research and information and so on, because again, you know, people who have an interest in this could delay the implementation of things by saying, you know, we don't have all the facts, we need more research and so on. I think in a lot of cases we know what the right things are that we have to do, and they are encapsulated in the flagship programs. We must just move on them. And the sector job resilience plans are also very welcome. And then in terms of ways forward, I think that is set out in our written submission.
Who sunk that boat there?
Probably the USA.
They thought Osama was on it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thought that was encapsulating a whole lot of points in a very short time. That's much appreciated. All right, questions? Was it so clear that no one has a question? Well, let me start again and they'll catch up. Charlie? Surely? I had difficulty understanding Mr. Taylor's explanation just now. You all seem to be a bit clearer to me. You see, I haven't got a colored picture yet, but this is the presentation the department made. And this is how they sketch that scenario. This top one here is your business as usual as a trajectory. So it's right from there. It can be anything at that level. And then here they do the other projections, which they've got a legend here. And what they said to us is that both the upper limit and the bottom limit of their trajectory that they're going for falls within the science required by science. They put it in there. Now, it seems to me that you differ from that. So you say that the lower one by 2050 is going to take us, the lower level will meet the target, but the upper level is not going to meet the target. So are you disagreeing with their, and I specifically ask them that question. I say, is our whole trajectory falling within science as required? And they said yes. Which you all seem to be slightly different, if you can explain that. Sorry. I don't know what I did to who, but they just started choking me here, Charlie. Was it you? Any other questions, Mr. Morgan?
Thanks very much. Thank you for a very, very clear presentation. I'm interested in you expanding on what I think you referred to as some of the political decisions that may have led us to a point where, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm trying to, you were, I guess, intentionally vague, which have put us in a position where, I guess, the plans for the future take into account certain projects, which I guess have been planned for some time anyway, as if to say that the decline will only happen thereafter because we have to get a whole bunch of stuff done. And you referred to it as certain political decisions. I'm interested in you explicitly telling the committee what those are. Whether any of those decisions in your mind can be reversed at this stage.
Mr. Grayling.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not just doing this to prove that I didn't just come here for the food. No, the issue with the required by science, I think what complicates this issue, though, is that this is a global problem. So there's what's required by science on a global level, and then once that is agreed upon, it then comes down to what is required politically from each nation state in terms of meeting that required by science. Now, we don't have that political agreement. That's part of the problem. All we have, essentially, is what South Africa is committed to at Copenhagen in terms of that. So I think what's confusing this issue, and certainly for me as well, is to say, are you saying that in terms of what's in the white paper, we won't meet our commitments that we made in Copenhagen, or that we won't meet what you think is our fair share of what's required by science on a global level. Because I think that is a distinction that needs to be made. I mean, I know that EarthLife was talking about reducing the target to 1.5 degrees. Now, of course, that's going to require a greater commitment from us, but it's also going to require a far greater commitment from the rest of the world as well. So I think that's a complicating factor, and I think if you can just unpackage that a bit. When you say required by science, is that required by us in terms of science, or is that what you see as our fair share of what's required by science?
There are two other things while I've got food in my mouth. Not only Mr. Kreling. The first one is the white paper makes no mention of the fund, whatever you want to call it, the green fund. I would want to hear your comment on that. I would have thought if one of the things we're pushing in international negotiations is exactly technology and a fund, it becomes quite important that we have a structural arrangement that can deal with that. And the paper, I think the green paper did mention something, but now it seems to be left out. Your comment on that. The other thing I see people are not commenting on, which you assisted us as a committee a while back by sending us information, is that there's still, the paper is silent on whether we need legislation. My gut feeling, which is substantial, I may add, as you can see, my gut feeling is that that there's a need for legislation. To get a framework like this to work, it seems to me you have to create those kind of institutional arrangements, the targets, the institutional arrangements you want, and so on, in legislation, to give it some status. My view is that clearly legislation is stronger than a policy document, in the sense that it gives people duties and responsibilities to act, and also then a duty to respond. The paper's silent. The previous paper actually was said, there's no need for it, but now it's silent at least. I would want to hear just some comment, if you have any, on that factor as well. So those are two extra ones. Any other questions? Well, let's take those and see if there's some more afterwards. Ms. Nodia?
Okay, so if I can take Honourable Member Kreiling's and Honourable Member De Lange's questions about reaching the required by science levels together. How do I do this now? Okay. If we look at those, the top trajectory and the bottom of the range, orange one, it's not that neither of them, well, the bottom one takes us to required by science a bit faster, obviously. But it's not that we won't reach required by science using the top range. It's just that we will reach it later. And by then, we may already have overshot the amount of emissions we should be putting into the atmosphere. So it just means harder and sharper things later rather than...
Let me just make it clear. You see, he's here, his cutoff is 2050.
Yeah.
So he's saying that both of them are within the range of required science by 2050. Your picture, there, it says the one gets there by 2050,
yeah.
But the one will get there later, let's say in 2050.
70 or 60 or something.
60 or whatever. So there's a difference in that position, and I'm trying to work out what the difference, whether firstly you agree that there is a difference, because you know, we'll have to check with the department why you guys think it's different. So that is just really the question, is that they're saying definitely both of them are in. Both, the top and the bottom.
Yeah.
Whereas you guys say only the bottom is in by 2050. So that's really just the, on the basis of what Mr. Kreiling asked.
So the numbers that I've put there are out of the white paper. So that 428 megatons of CO2 equivalent by 2050 comes out of the white paper. So unless they've shifted or redefined what is required by science, or have got it wrong, then I don't understand the difference, to be honest, Mr. Lung. And I think perhaps I would go and query it and come back with a written answer to the committee.
You can also look at there is a document available we can give you where they explain this picture.
Oh, we would welcome that so much.
It is available. Members have got it already.
Oh, no, we would really welcome that. Because the more we share information and get on the same page, the better. Okay, so that is the one thing. The other thing is that is the question of the global budget and the carving up thereof. So, Mr. Kraling, you're quite right that we haven't yet reached a deal at an international level which carves up the global budget in a fair way. But in the meantime, what we can do is take our commitments and say that that's what we'll take as our budget. So if we say, this was going to be our business as usual trajectory, we've committed to those cuts. So you take business as usual, you minus those cuts, and that gives you your carbon budget for South Africa that's in line with your own commitments. So we are working, as WWF, we're working with that as the workable carbon budget. But the more you push that line up, business as usual, the bigger carbon budget it gives you for the country. And that's why there are vested interests which are wanting to push it up. And I mean, I don't want to name them, but I can whisper them to you in an ear. They argue
some of the sinners were here earlier.
They argue that the way we plotted business as usual was in the first place too low. And therefore, if you cut off a higher line, then you still don't cut that much. So it's in that sense that I say this is a political question. I'm not critiquing particular decisions taken to date. I'm saying it's now a matter of political will, what decisions we make from now, and how fast we move towards the low-carbon options. And I'm saying that at an international level, the global carbon budget and the carving up thereof is a political question. So I hope that clarifies for Mr. Morgan. What is very important in the decisions we make now is that we don't get locked in to certain infrastructure decisions that will leave us with stranded assets. Perhaps in 20 years' time, if we build too many coal-fired power stations, we'll still be stuck with a carbon-intensive economy, and we will no longer be competitive in the world. So those are the kinds of decisions we shouldn't get locked into. Another example in my presentation was this granting of prospecting licenses. Fracking in the Karoo might be another. We do things that are irreversible and lock us into a certain kind of future which is not where we need to be going anyway. Okay, then in terms of the... Oh, I just want to say also that at the UNFCCC, under the Kyoto Protocol, certain countries have made commitments to cut. Whether they've stuck to those or not, I'm not going to speak about now. But the cuts that are on the table at the moment at the UNFCCC negotiations bring us to a 3-degree global average increase world. So clearly inadequate what's going on there at the moment. Then in terms of the fund, as I understand it, SANBI, the South African National Biodiversity Institute, has been accredited by the Adaptation Fund to be a national implementing entity for South Africa. That's on the adaptation side. But in terms of the Green Fund, quite right, we would have to get a national institution up and running and ready to receive funds. In our response to the Green Paper, we had argued that we could create a national adaptation fund, or maybe now we should call it a national green fund, in such a way that it would be ready to be an accredited institution under the UNFCCC rules, but where it's up and running for our own purposes anyway. And I see Mr. Lange doesn't quite agree with me about Sandy.
No, so I'm just very surprised that one institution that deals with biodiversity is a point. I mean, it's a surprise at what you're telling me, not that I disagree.
Okay. And then, in terms of legislation, no, we absolutely would agree with the chairperson that we're very excited about this idea of sectoral budgets, sectoral plans, and target outcomes, and to give those real teeth and make them mandatory will involve legislation, certainly. And we were suggesting that in that two-year period, while all the processes go on to, obviously it will be a stakeholder process and to set all those targets and plans and budgets, that perhaps Parliament could prepare a bill in the meantime. In parallel.
Mr. Lukey. You just arrived at the right time. People are saying you're a liar and a cheat.
We did not.
And a conniver. Look, I can go through a lot of adjectives that have been said here today. But I'm going to just spare you with those few ones. And they didn't say government, they said particular Peter Lukey. They pointed you out as the charlatan. Peter, look, you gave us this picture. I don't have it in color. I don't know where my color one is. You know this one where you explained the trajectory and so on. And as I understood it, you explained that both the upper and the lower limit of the PPD trajectory falls within the science as required. If I understood you correctly. Now, it seems that some of the organizations that gave inputs here are indicating that the top one, the upper limit, according to your own figures of 4 to 8, will not reach the target within 2050. As you can see up there, the green one. The blue one reaches the bottom part of the trajectory. Just explain to me what your picture is and what it actually says. I mean, obviously, you'll have to engage with these organizations to find out why they're saying it's less, if there's a disagreement, and I'd like you to do that, to find out where we are. But just explain again to me how you, in the white paper, understand this picture, if you don't mind.
No, the greatest pleasure. And I've just actually, Chair, I've only joined you now, through any sign of disrespect. I've just been briefing the NCOP on the white paper as well. And in actual fact, the same question was raised there as well. And even in terms of being called a charlatan and what have you, I've probably been called worse in my life as well. Chair,
we defended you vigorously.
Thank you kindly, I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. Chair, within the situation, first of all, the discussions around the trajectory are often quite moot, in a sense, and that's, first of all, the required by science that was given in the long-term mitigation scenarios was once again, even though it had the title required by science, was what we as a nation thought would be a fair contribution to global efforts. So in terms of, for instance, we never went to the extent of actually sort of doing some kind of a global carbon budgeting process to find...
Yeah, until the world tells us what is our part, we don't know what our part is, and we've had to assume.
Absolutely. So if one reads the long-term mitigation scenarios and reads the... So that, on that blue line that you have there, which is the required by science trajectory shown in the long-term mitigation scenarios, it was basically an assumption saying
that... That's what we committed ourselves to, the blue one.
We never committed ourselves to it, but it was basically, that was the line that was provided in the long-term mitigation scenario that was called growth without constraints.
Yeah.
And in the LTMS process, which was basically the multi-stakeholder process and the scenario building team consensus, was that blue line should be our aspirational goal. It's what we as a nation should aspire to. And within that situation, that was based on looking at South Africa's carbon emissions, looking at our developing nation status, and what we would consider as being a fair contribution to international efforts. Now, in that sort of sense, if you say it's what we would consider, it is a completely subjective, and if one could go one step further, sort of say a political decision, more than anything else. If one starts looking at a scientific basis, then one has to agree on the basis of the science. And if, for instance, you start taking global emissions and global concentrations and dividing it by, as of yesterday, the 7 billion human beings, and finding out what would be a fair contribution for each if you just basically divide it through all the human beings in the world, and then coming back and finding out what South Africa's situation should be, to be honest, it would probably be lower than that. Relatively small population, with a large carbon footprint. That blue line, if one calculated it that way, would probably be lower. But if one then took into account that we're a developing nation and this is a level of poverty and what have you. So in other words, that blue line itself is subjective. It's a political statement. So within all these sort of situations, the green line there is not based on any basic science. The green line, the green range that we're going to, is seen as a fair contribution. The NGOs would normally sort of say, well, you know, providing a range is all very well, but industry will always head for the upper limit of that range. Well, of course, I mean, that is an opinion.
Human nature. They're more human than most of us, but that's human nature.
The reality is that if one starts looking at the actual average of that range, the average lies very, very close to our Copenhagen undertaking, if one has calculated from the growth without constraints. So basically what is argued here, Chair, is that in terms of the popularized conceptions of South Africa's peak plateau and decline trajectory, which is shown there as the Copenhagen undertaking calculated from growth without constraints, the required by science from LTMS, and Cabinet's picture of what was a peak plateau and decline, then the white paper contains figures that basically encapsulate all of those. So, and it also shows quite dramatically that is quite it is a significant departure from business as usual. The other aspect that has to be taken into account, Chair, is that there has never ever been any statement about what the decline should look like. So in other words, in our Copenhagen undertaking, we talked about we will peak at this time, but there was never a sort of situation about what the decline would actually look like eventually. And to a large extent, and the background document of the white paper specifically says that, it says in the absence of any clarity on what the post-2035 situation looks like, what we've done is basically taken that range based on the LTMS's required by science, because that was the only trajectory that was published in the public domain, and basically put that range around the LTMS's required by science. And that's it. It has to be accepted that this is what we're doing as the benchmark. And we must measure ourselves against it. And I'm hoping that there'll be lots of research about what is possible and what we should be really doing and what have you, and that the scientific community will keep on looking at this picture and criticizing it and critiquing it and what have you.
What's the July 2008 PPD illustration?
That was the illustration that came out to illustrate Cabinet Lekgotla's climate change directions from the July 2008 Cabinet Lekgotla. And that was the Minister of Environment had a press conference after Cabinet Lekgotla, and to illustrate what Cabinet had said by having a peak plateau and decline, the Minister used that red line as an illustration of what Cabinet had agreed would be our peak plateau and decline.
So if you look at that then, to understand it correctly, we have agreed on an LTMS science as required, which is really taking a whole lot of factors into consideration what we have decided, and that's the blue one.
Yep.
Then Cabinet met in 2008 and basically said the red one. And what we've agreed in the white paper is the green band, which includes the red and the blue, and of course, even if everything goes perfectly, is quite far below even the blue, quite a big chunk below its green. So that's really what we've done, to include both those projections in it. And as you say, take into consideration that we've agreed to a peak, but not
to the trajectory itself and so on. So I think I understand it more clearly. So what we're saying is the green then encapsulates the different positions we've had at different times as a country. But until we have, which Mr. Grayling's point is, until the world, which they'll never do, so we're quite safe, until the world agrees to a carbon footprint and divides the chunks up, and we all have one comprehensive legal agreement for the world where each one of us are told this is our targets and so on, then clearly this is our own projections and what we're thinking we should try and do before then, if I'm understanding you correctly. And therefore, there may be interpretations within that trajectory that different people will have, because it's a trajectory that has got some space in it. Okay. No, I understand that. Is there any questions flowing from that, Ms. Nodia? You shouldn't be asking questions, but let me...
So, we are not disagreeing with anything that Peter said, but what we are appealing for, and I think now in this diagram I can see the answer to your question, if you look at the top of the red band, it is above the top of the blue band. So if the blue is the required by science agreed band, then so that correlates with our picture.
So what Mr. Lugie says, originally we agreed to the LTMS as the blue band. Then when Cabinet met in 2008, they revised it to the red band.
To the range.
To the, well, no, to the red.
Yeah, but
and
the bottom
what we've
of the
done, red. But what we've done as a white paper, we've now made a green rain band, which includes both those and give some extra at the bottom here for the green. So we've now got three within that range.
So I think what we're saying in our submission is we're not fighting with any of that, and our numbers do agree with the white papers, but we are appealing that that might all be semantically correct, but the urgency of the problem and the disastrous nature of the problem requires us to be more ambitious than the range in the white paper. That's really our argument. And we're saying sooner rather than later, because the longer we wait, the worse the discrepancy gets.
Okay, that's clear. Mr. Grayling?
Thank you, Chair. Just two points of clarity. The one is, if we include the red range that's there as well, does that, according to Mr. Madea and according to Peter Lukey, does that conform to the commitment we made in Copenhagen? I mean, does that range incorporate that? And then secondly, you said that there's discussion around the business as usual trajectory and saying that there's some parties that are trying to move that down. I mean, if we can get clarity then from Mr. Lukey as to whether that is the case or is there an agreement on the business as usual? But over there, it's actually a range as well. I mean, it's not a fixed line. So
big that I don't think it makes any difference.
Yeah.
It's so wide. When it was a single line, it made a difference. But now that it's this range. But in any case, let Mr. Lukey. Mr. Lukey, you want to answer those? I'll take him next, Mr. Morgan.
Thank you, Chair. The Copenhagen undertaking calculated from the published long-term mitigation scenarios growth without constraints is there, the purple line, and you can see it falls between the blue and the red if it's calculated from that.
2020 to 2025.
Correct. So it is there, and it's illustrated there. The whole sort of situation around, look, there's a double-edged sword in terms of that business-as-usual cone, to be honest. And the cone was chosen for the simple reason that to predict a future with sort of accuracy down to a particular number is impossible, and we all know this. But to provide some sort of indication of where we're expecting to go, that's what that cone does. But it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's argued that, hang on a second, it's so broad, you know, we could do anything and it would be there. The reality is that if, for instance, if our emissions still fall within that mustard-colored cone, we would have to regard it as being business as usual.
Yeah, we're in trouble.
We're in trouble. And very few people actually see it in that sort of situation. It's just, it's just open-ended, we could do anything. The reality is that we have to do something significant to get outside the business-as-usual trajectory. So in that sense, the publication of this quite a broad cone is actually a very courageous move. And to be honest, if one concerns any other country's published undertakings, this is progressive by any stretch of the imagination. For a developing country, is extremely progressive. It's indicative of a country that is taking this issue exceptionally seriously and is actually taking its global responsibilities very, very carefully.
Mr. Morgan?
I think
I just want to ask a question to Mr. Lukey. Okay, I understand looking at the green range, and I understand now how everything is fitted into that. So thank you for for clearing that up. I just want to understand, in terms of the process that government tends to go through with regards to setting the carbon budget, basically, for the various industrial sectors. I mean, what you're saying is that at this point now, 2011, that is the kind of broad range we want to be in. That's not to say we have any intention of abiding by it necessarily. We may very well want to be more ambitious as we go along. And that actually the mechanism of the carbon budgeting in the year 2011 intends to operate within those limits, but of course can be readjusted any time to be more ambitious. Okay. The second point, of course, and this is really my view on the legislation, or whatever, we can obviously debate it, is that it would seem to me, this is only a white paper, it's a kind of framework document, it doesn't in any respect bind us to anything, actually. It's a very, very important document, Mr. Lukey, so I'm not trying to be disparaging of it, but, we can change any moment. The reality is that, we have to somehow come up with the mechanisms, of course, and perhaps that is legislative, which basically allows the various stakeholders, including the people in this room, the actual members of Parliament, I would imagine, to be able to actually say to you as government, actually, we don't like your range, quite frankly, and we want it to be more ambitious. So essentially, I want you to say, this is 2011. Your idea basically is this: the carbon budget. We're going to broadly fit into that, and then I'm asking just on your initial thoughts. I know it's early days, but the mechanisms, because I can understand a framework. It sends certain signals to business and various other players, but I think there also has to be some reassurances, and perhaps this is the role of the portfolio committee, and you may bounce it back into my court immediately, that actually we're not bound by this, we can actually change it, take into account the various drivers and what is possible and what science requires at any time using, for example, a legislative mechanism.
Mr. Lukey? So the Honourable Morgan offered me a complete escape hatch there by just saying, well, this is your issue. But I'll be a bit more courageous and I'll actually respond. The process that lies ahead of us in terms of the budgeting aspect and then actually bending the curve is what it's called, is not going to be easy by any stretch of the imagination. And certainly when in the discussions we've had with some of the large industrial sectors around this particular drawing itself, and also the white paper in terms of looking at emission reduction outcomes and carbon budgets and so on and so forth, they've returned to us and they sort of said, look, this is a hugely divisive process that you have ahead of. Basically, sectors are going to be pitted against other sectors. And we know this. We know this is not going to be an easy task. We know that, for instance, the electricity generation sector are going to stake their claim, and we've seen that they've already kind of staked a claim within the IRP, and they've sort of said 50% of the carbon space is ours. We would probably question that. But then, then other companies are coming through and sort of saying, process emissions, there's nothing we can do about this. Like making cement requires, if South Africa wants cement, they then must take the carbon with it. And so there's going to be a lot of arm wrestling and horse trading, I think, around this sort of situation. And eventually, government will have to govern. There'll have to be some hard decisions that you cannot negotiate. But throughout the process, I think what we're hoping is that over this process, that what we'll do is gather the information to make informed decisions, so that when the decisions are made, they can go back on the mitigation potential, a cost-benefit analysis, looking at a cost abatement curve, and so on and so forth, that can be used as justification for certain decisions. That will basically support the South African economy rather than undermine it. But it's, as I said, it is not going to be easy. By any stretch of the imagination, this is not going to be an easy task. The easier ones, the lower hanging fruit, are probably around our national utilities. Things like, for instance, with the IRP, actually getting the carbon budgets on the ESCOM and then having a look at that sort of situation. That is, I mean, that's the easier ones. In terms of the private sector, it's far more difficult. And in that sort of situation, perhaps we have to start looking at that. And I mean, let's think about it. I mean, we're already going legislative approach. In terms of things like publishing energy efficiency standards for buildings, it's already happening. So it's not a case of going to property developers and sort of saying, please reduce your carbon footprint. We are legislating for it, that there are new building standards and codes that will reduce the carbon footprints of buildings. We will not go to car manufacturers and sort of say, please, please start increasing the energy efficiency of your vehicles. They'll start feeling the impact of the tax when they, you know, if they start producing really, really energy inefficient bricks on wheels, and people sort of say, look, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay that tax on this vehicle. They'll start feeling that. And so there is already regulatory elements that are being used. And so within that, the biggest lesson that we've learned throughout this process is there's no one size fits all. You actually have to use a range of regulatory, economic, and other tools, including, for instance, just purely name and shame. I mean, just the whole aspect of market and those sort of elements to actually change behaviors. And I guess throughout this process, when what we'll be looking at is exactly that sort of situation, is looking at, once we start getting those kind of budgets, what would be the best regulatory mechanisms we can use to do that. We've seen, for example, that voluntary mechanisms, you know, they have a role to play. How effective they are tends to be a matter of debate. I mean, in many instances, we have a situation where there's a voluntary agreement where a company or steps in and out depending on how they're doing. You know, if they're doing well, then they stay in the agreement. If they're doing terrible, then they just step out of the agreement. And we've seen this around various things, like plastic bags and so on and so forth. So, but they have their role to play. They're normally relatively cheap. The administrative burden lies on the industry rather than on government. So we have to explore all of these things, and I'm hoping over the next 2 years that's exactly what we'll be doing.
The fact of the matter is, Mr. Lukey, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can debate whether it's ambitious enough, more ambitious. The fact of the matter is, as this picture stands, at 2010, the amount of carbon is 547. Right? According to the map. Within the next 9 years, we can increase only 30-something ton. That's the most difficult part of everything. That in the next 9 years, according to this plan, at the top end of the plan, not at the bottom end of the plan, at the top end of the plan, we can in 9 years only increase 30-odd tons. Okay? Which is, I mean, I don't know what we're going to do. We're probably going to shoot all the drivers so that people can't drive and so on. But they're going to have to do something. Then by, so that's 547, it goes up to 583 by 2020. In the next 5 years after that, it peaks at 614. Then there's a 10-year plateau where it stays at 614, and then it starts declining down to 492 in 25. So, you know, whether one argues about it and how ambitious it is not, the reality of it is, if you just look at the numbers, you can see how impossible the job is. Because in the next 9 years, we can only increase 30-odd tons. Which already just shows you that we've got huge problems. So, I mean, at least I hope that makes it clearer what the picture is and how it's explained and how we got there and so on. So I hope that helps somewhat. Of course, that then means that the pictures that do suggest that maybe one is slightly outside of the scientific thing would probably be right at the upper limit. At the bottom limit, of course, it's far below whatever the required thing is. Of course, as I always say with this thing, it's like a snowball. Snowballs start small. If you roll it down a hill, it becomes enormous. So hopefully things like renewable energy, the fact of the matter that you've got a BAU that is so wide, is exactly that as you get more aggressive with things like renewable energy and so on, that is why the possibilities are that this could start happening. Because the more ambitious you get, the more strong you get with your actions for cleaner energy, that gives you a big scope. But that also has to happen so drastically that it doesn't actually follow that line, that actually starts going down. That's the important thing. And as I say, a snowball does that. picks up snow, it gets bigger and bigger. So as you introduce taxes, as you introduce budget, carbon budgets, as you get sectors to get there, as you create storage place for carbon, as you do all those different things, hopefully that is what starts pushing this trajectory down and starts getting people to act and change their behavior and so on. So in effect, I mean, those wise words, I don't know where I found them, that were put up here earlier, that this is going to be a hell of a tough. And you, as I say, the toughness of it is lies in the fact that in the next 3 years, we cannot increase by more than 40 tons. Next 9 years, we cannot increase with more than 40 tons. Shows you how difficult this process now is. So I think that it helps us to understand this. And what it also helps us to understand is why at least twice a year, which I will, as long as I'm chair of this committee, I'll be suggesting it, twice a year we'll have to get together as a committee to see that these things are happening. And departments come and report through the intergovernmental structure, come and report to us how far we are with these things. Because we need to keep our public informed all along. Are we here? Are we there? Where are we on this? Because it will show you how more radical we have to get and how tougher we'll have to get with our budget allocations, with our sector targets. And the longer you leave it, the worse it gets. Because you buy into technology and stuff and you go in a certain direction, and then to change that, you really got problems. So I hope that makes it a bit clearer where we are. Are there any other questions to Ms. Nodia? To Mr. Luki? Just, I forgot to say to the committee, I do have, always there's a member of the department here that makes a summary of the inputs for us to keep a record, okay, of the thing. So if the committee is just aware that we always will have someone here that does that for us from the department, making sure that they feed those submissions back to Mr. Luki. Mr. Luki, the other thing is, the more I think about this paper, the more I think of it as a framework and not actually a policy paper. Because, I mean, obviously the overall targets and that are policies from government in the sense of adapting it. But it's not policies as we understand them, you know, transport policies. So we should actually have a look at that and maybe look at how we frame it. That it's really a framework in which we respond to climate change as a government. Okay, any other questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Nadea. I really appreciate the very good
input. Thank you to the committee.
Thank you. Can I just quickly make a few announcements to the committee? Firstly, we have now received an invitation from Mr. Frolik's office. Mr. Skosana, don't smile. We have now received an invitation from Mr. Frolik's office that the whole committee is invited to attend the Globe meeting in Cape Town on the 3rd and the 4th, I think, and the IPU on the 5th. And we must use our budget to provide for that. So please, I urgently need people's names who will be at those two meetings. No one has mentioned the COP yet. I'm hearing that the different chief whips are responsible to decide for their size part of the delegation. I think it's 10 ANC and 5 opposition or something. 2 DA, 2... was it COPE? 2 and then 1 of the smaller parties. So, but that has not come to us. They're telling us those are other processes. It's just these two meetings that... and you remember I told you that at one stage we got approval for the whole committee to go to COP, to be there. And then later we said, no, this has to be part of the delegation and so on. So I'm very sorry. Things are a bit confused. I can't... let me leave it at that. The second issue was... what other meetings are TRIPS out? There was another trip or something I had to... I'm sure I'll remember tomorrow, and I'll tell you tomorrow. But just please, let us have those names of people that will go to those two meetings so that we can make the necessary bookings and so on. And then whatever it is, the second thing I wanted to say to you, I'll remember it by tomorrow and I'll tell you. Please now remember the program. Tomorrow again from 9 till 1. We've got 6 inputs tomorrow. Next Tuesday, next Wednesday morning again. And then in the third week, Tuesday, Wednesday and Friday. Please book that Friday afternoon. I've asked you to be here one Friday this year. Okay? Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. And I can see there's no resistance, not even from Charlie. Tomorrow we're meeting in committee room 3 in those dingy little rooms down there, 90 Plain Street. We'll start again at 9. We're meeting first with Future Energies, Access, SANBI, Gender Commission, and the Water Research Commission. Okay? Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned. What was the other thing I wanted to talk about? Huh? What is the other thing that I forgot? Mr. Frolic was the one thing, but there was another. Either a trip or some announcement I had to make. We never were. Now what we've never received, we ask on a daily basis for a response from Frolic's office. He's never responded. They have to agree to it.
Hi Dean, it's Anona, how are you? I'm good, thank you. Is the PM in? Okay. All right, I'll call yourself, thanks.
This is a rich audience that we had, but someone forgot their key. If you don't come and fetch it now, I'll be driving this car. I don't know where it is, but I'll find it. I'll walk around all these parking areas until I find this car.
Hello, what's happening? Hi. Are you still in office? I can come and see you this afternoon. Oh, are you? Okay. Are you? Okay. What time would be good for you? 2, 3? 2. Okay. All right. To see you. Bye. Tomorrow. Okay.